Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Is How to Win Friends and Influence People has been around for generations. We should tell you the book is published by Simon & Schuster, a CBS company. But what's really interesting is that now it's been updated for the digital age. Not bad for an author who got his start early in the last century. Richard Schlesinger of 48 Hours has his story.
Dale Carnegie made a fortune by preaching that nice guys can finish first by following the golden rule. And his business is still going strong 75 years after he published his simple recipe for success. Just two steps, win friends and influence people.
What was his philosophy in a nutshell?
That you can change people's behavior by changing your attitude toward them.
Peter Handel is the latest CEO of the Carnegie Empire that sells those books and teaches those courses, promising to bring you out of your shell, speak better, listen better, be a better person, and persuade other people to do what you want.
I got to disagree.
Do you know how many people have taken the course?
We estimate 8 million.
That was 8 million?
8 million.
That's the size of a country.
Some countries, that's right, exactly right.
And there are some impressive alumni. Orville Redenbacher took the course, so did Warren Buffett and John Boehner. Students are attracted in large part by the book, How to Friends and Influence People, published in 1936. It's a collection of parables and principles, simple business advice, more Hallmark than Harvard, like smile.
Be nice to people. Mm-hmm. Don't humiliate them. Don't bully them. So, with apologies, why do people need to pay good money to learn that?
It's common sense. The difference is it's not common practice.
We're going to start today with a representation of what may be going on every time you try to convey a message.
At a Dale Carnegie class, everyone speaks, sometimes at the same time, learning to get their message across. This course, which costs close to $2,000 for 8 sessions, is pretty much the same today as it was when Carnegie himself started teaching 99 years ago.
When you can agreeably disagree on something, that future endeavors with each other, it usually comes back, you know? And you.
Bernie Dix was sent here by his boss at a New York City dry cleaners.
Yeah, for tailoring, yeah, I can't do it. I'm sorry.
By his own admission, he had a few issues dealing with customers.
Who do I have to call, Marlene and Lorraine?
He's working on it, though.
I've learned how to pause. You know,
how to pause
before I react, you know, to think about what I'm saying before it comes out of my mouth, which is something I never quite had a grasp on.
You know? Did you used to tell off customers or?
I had rough edges. Okay. You get to approach it from a different angle at a future date. You don't close the door.
He's a little smoother now, he says, thanks in part to this somewhat chaotic exercise.
Okay, 30 seconds, please begin.
The Mets form suck.
As required by Dodd-Frank.
I said it on
unsustainable debt.
You know, $160 in payroll.
What did you learn from that?
Two people talking at the same time doesn't work.
But you didn't need a class to know that, did you?
Dealing with the public on a daily basis, you sometimes forget. So when you come back in, we'll straighten it all out. All right?
Take care.
Dale Carnegie started teaching his classes in 1912. He was born dirt poor on a farm in Maryville, Missouri, but he went to college. The story is he turned to public speaking to win friends in college since he wasn't very athletic and felt inferior to the jocks. After college, he became a traveling salesman. He did well. He tried acting. He did not do well.
May I give you one little bit of advice, please?
Later in life, he tried acting again.
When you're talking to somebody, why not let the other person finish what he said?
That's Carnegie playing himself in the movie Jiggs and Maggie in Society, starring nobody else most people have ever heard of.
Mr. Carnegie, I didn't come here to be insulted.
Temper, temper, temper.
But by then, in real life, almost everyone had heard of him. Hundreds of thousands had signed up to hear him speak.
The man who's enthusiastic will find the scales tipped in his favor. And a man of second-rate ability with enthusiasm will outstrip a man of first-rate ability without enthusiasm.
He didn't knock people off their perches, you know. I think that was a secret of his charm for audience, why people liked to hear him speak, was that you knew this is a real person talking, dude.
The late Dorothy Carnegie was Dale's wife. She spoke in this 1994 interview.
He is not a stuffy man at all. And he was just so down-to-earth, you felt like you'd known him all your life.
He'd been teaching for more than 20 years when an editor for Simon & Schuster took his class and convinced him to write a book, the book that launched the empire. It's estimated that sold more than 30 million copies.
This is the original manuscript of
Yes.
How to Win Friends and Influence People. This is under glass preserved, much like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are.
Brenda Johnson is the keeper of the Carnegie flame and an indirect descendant of his. She's in charge of the Heritage Room at Dale Carnegie headquarters in Hopaug, Long Island.
It's important to our history. It's a part of who Dale Carnegie was and what this company was about. He wrote How to Win Friends as a textbook to go along with his classes.
And now the book has been updated for the digital age. Turns out you can win friends and influence people virtually anytime, even if you never actually see them.
Dale Carnegie was very big on smiling. Mm-hmm. How do you smile in an email with... I guess there's an emoticon.
You know, there is, and that means that's
what would
nice.
He have thought of emoticons?
I don't know. That's a very good question. But you can choose words that will communicate that if it takes longer.
Okay, sir, tell me how you smile in an email.
Just saying, I'm having a great day. I hope you are too. I mean, that's kind of a pleasant way of saying something.
But then you have to say, you know, where are the sales reports?
Yeah, well, right. You get to that.
Well, it just so happens that Dale Carnegie...
And by all reports, sales at Dale Carnegie give the company every reason to smile. Today, the courses are offered in more than 80 countries, from China to Cameroon.
It strikes me that a lot of the stories that he tells in his book are quintessentially American stories. So how does that translate to somebody in Beijing?
That's a fascinating question, Richard, because that's something I've been really...
Dale Carnegie enjoying. Told you to say that, didn't
he? No, that's not true. Well, actually, he did, but I would have said it before.
Right.
The fact is, because human nature is the same all over the world, the principles that Dale Carnegie teaches really do work all over the world.
What do we want people to do as a result of our experience?
And as humans, it apparently feels natural to pay someone to tell us, be nice to others, follow the golden rule, even though parents and grandparents have been giving that advice for generations and for free.
You see this motherfucker?
Blessings, blessings. Yeah, blessings, blessings. I see. Elephant's house on the bow of a sailing lady, docked on the Ivory Coast. Mercedes in a row, winding down the road. I hope my black skin don't dirt this white tuxedo before the bus got sure. And if so, well, fuck it, fuck it. Because this water drowned my family. This water makes my blood. This water tells my story. This water knows it all. Go ahead and spill some champagne in the water. Go ahead and watch the sun blaze on the waves of the ocean.
Dope boy still smelling like cocaine. White boat, white road, can he be more cleaner? The oil you spill at BP ain't clean up. I'm anti, Santa Maria. Only Christopher we acknowledge is Wallace. I don't even like Washington's in my pocket. Black card go hard when I'm shopping. Boat docked in front of her man's picking cotton. Silk and fleeces, lay on my Jesus. Oh my God, I hope y'all don't get seasick. See me in shit you never saw. If it wasn't for these pictures, they wouldn't see me at all. Whole world's in awe. I crash through glass ceilings, I break through closed doors. I'm on the ocean, I'm in heaven. Yachting, Ocean 11.
Elephant's house on the bow of a sailing lady. Docked on the Ivory Coast. Mercedes in a row, winding down the road. I hope my black skin don't dirt this white tuxedo
before the bass got shook. And if so,
context of white supremacy, justice, Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, July 5th, 2013, so I have been told, at least for the folks listening in the area of the world known as the U.S., I hope you made it through the 4th safely. Did not end up being arrested, placed in greater confinement. The battle simulation, also known as fireworks, were pretty rapid and out of control around these parts. I suspect that was the case in a lot of different areas. I even saw where good old racist suspect Alex Jones, he was making videos talking about President Obama was declaring martial law. And anywho, I hope you all made it safely, and my apologies. I had intended to do a broadcast because I thought at minimum that could be, you know, at least a small counter-racist effort to do a program yesterday evening. I thought, you know, that might give victims an option as opposed to going out, potentially being in harm's way, lots of people on the roads under the influence, and lots of enforcement officers on the roads looking to practice racism and terrorize melanated drivers. So I had intended to do a program, but I was working. I was not frolicking. I was not barbecuing. I was on the counter-racist grind yesterday, and I just lost track of time. It got pretty late before I realized it. So my apologies. I hope folks were able to remain safe. At any rate, we will be back for tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific. Lots to talk about from the past week. Dial in if you find news reports, things you would like to discuss. Tune in, see if you can bring a non-white person. Looking forward. Workplace issues, if racism on the job, if you're having problems, difficulties. If you, like one of our female callers that dialed in a while back, boundaries on the job in terms of what you want to reveal, what you want to keep to yourself, definitely dial in. Always want to encourage non-white listeners to dial in who want to talk about dealing with white people on the job. I think that's something that we should be having. We should be talking about that at least as much as sexual intercourse. Moving forward. Today's broadcast, the 4th installment, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Enjoying the book. I hope it is giving out some constructive information. You heard the audio at the beginning of the book, the segment that CBS did on Mr. Carnegie. I thought it was significant that they said Mr. Carnegie felt inferior earlier in his life. I thought that is such a white thing to say. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing moment. We will get started. One thing I will emphasize, the timing of this book, and even I got this from some of the people who have been calling into the Saturday program and other listeners on saying that they have found the information, even though the author is a racist suspect, but they found some of the tips to be constructive, just ways that you can use words and things that you can pay attention to, just little things that you can control when you are having contact with another non-white person that can be helpful, that can reduce conflict, that can even make it easier for you to communicate with this person about racism, or maybe not about racism, just to have constructive communication that's efficient and without conflict and discourtesy. One thing I will emphasize is that I think this environment, I feel like the anti-blackness is just, it's really off the charts. I mean, just seeing black children being picked on and ridiculed publicly by white people and non-white people. I expect that from white people, but victims of racism, I expect it from us too, but I just feel like it is a symptom of that anti-blackness, our behavior, our disregard for other non-white people. And I feel like as white people increase their abuse and terrorism of non-white people, when we don't confront that, when we're not able to successfully neutralize them, we take out that frustration on one another. If it's a black male blaming a black female blaming a black male, or blaming black children, blaming black older people, just, you know, blaming any victim of racism. It's Clarence Thomas's fault. It's President Obama's fault. The problem is white people. I hope that these tips and just being aware of the fact that I think a lot of non-white people are, they're having a tough time. They're in a lot of pain. They are suffering the traumas of racism, white supremacy. And when you're frustrated, when you're being damaged and you're not getting help, you take those frustrations out. I think people have said repeatedly, hurt people hurt people. There are a lot of cliches that talk about that, but at the end of the day, I would expect, you all can confirm or not, you can reflect on your own experience the past few months if you are around other non-white people, if you're feeling like people are flying off the handle a little easier, if people are being a little snarky, if they are impatient, if things are quick to get hostile and profanities and what have you, that could be a symptom of the increased pressure that white people are applying. Now, I could be incorrect. I don't have a lot of fancy stats and charts to back that, but that's what I believe to be going on. Racist man, racist woman, when they're talking about the economy and all the other things that they're doing, just turning up the pressure on the plantation. And our track record is we tend to a lot of times take that out on one another. So I hope just hearing that and being aware that that could be happening, and then in addition to whatever other strategies you want to employ, this is not the only program where they've discussed ways of minimizing conflict with other non-white people. Mr. Fuller's talked about that a ton. Dr. Baruti, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, lots of people, even some of our former guests that have been on the program, Community Action Network, about the importance of recognizing, striving for better black mental health. Obviously, as Dr. Welsing said, we don't qualify for mental health, but striving to manage our trauma and striving to do the best that we can under really heinous conditions. That's it. Before we get started, we did have one listener. They felt Gus was not courteous in dealing with them on the program and wanted to recognize that could have been my own anti-blackness. None of us are immune. So definitely to that listener, I had already spoke with them or attempted to communicate that with them, but just to make sure that's emphasized, definitely don't want to be discourteous with any victims of racism. Sometimes, hey, we all fail, but we want to try and correct that as best we can. So apologies to the victim of racism who felt Gus was not courteous. I think they also felt that there was also some discourteous behavior in the chat room. If we could watch that, just like I said, just kind of keep in mind, racists really are doing a job on us worldwide. The anti-blackness going after non-white people, really just kind of keep that in mind. If somebody is being rude or doing whatever, resist the urge to go back at them. Resist the urge. You can minimize contact, you can take space, you can do a lot of things. I'm not saying just allow people to mistreat you. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just saying manage, be conscious, be mindful of how we respond to other victims of racism, even victims of racism who are not being courteous, even victims of racism who might be doing things that are incorrect. Let's really make sure that we respond in the best manner possible. Right on. With that, we will go ahead and get started. I'll give out the number before, or actually I'll wait. I'll play the first segment and then I'll give out the number once we come back. So sit back. I'll give notes just to catch everybody up, since if you get the ebook version of How to Win Friends, it has an accompanying guide that just has bullet points of important points that you should be picking up along the way. So I'll just refresh us as we go. 6 ways to make people like you become genuinely interested in other people. Number 2, smile. Number 3, remember a person's name. Number 4, be a good listener. Encourage others to talk about themselves. Number 5, talk in terms of the other person's interest. Number 6, make the other person feel important and do it sincerely. Next, win people to your way of thinking. The only way to get the best of an argument is to avoid it. Show respect for the other person's opinions. Never say you're wrong. That is all bold print and in red letters. Never say you're wrong. Next, if you are wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically. That is also in red bold face print. The next one is begin in a friendly way. And I think that's important too. I'll stop there because he's going to cover a lot of these in the segment this week. I'll stop there. I also think it's important to recognize, because I do this as well, recognize if there is hostility, if the person is not really interested in friendly dialogue. I recognize and I shut down myself. I shut down, so I don't do as much talking. That way it also reduces the likelihood that there's going to be a conflict and an argument. I try to recognize early on if someone is looking discourteous, hostile, that they're not really looking for friendly dialogue. And I would say, unfortunately, many times victims of racism, because of our training, because of our victimization, we're not looking for friendly dialogue with other non-white people. We're looking for an argument. We're looking to get that person told. We're willing to let them know how dumb and ignorant they are. Unfortunately, not always, but many times. We'll go ahead and get started. Just to highlight before we roll, the song from Jay-Z's new album, you all can say that you heard it before it even came out. The reason it's there, he is talking about racism, white supremacy in the song, even in the very hook. Don't let my black skin dirt this white tuxedo. I mean, and all throughout the song, he's talking about racism regularly. Now, that could be an argument. Many people, hey, I don't think he's representative of a non-white person working against racism. And he talks about a lot of wackiness and blah, 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 and all, even the name of the company. All valid. You could go and you could start up an argument. Non-white person who, you know, is a fan, is looking forward to the new album. You could go that route. Start an argument. Even the non-white male who's singing the chorus. I believe this person either is reported or suspected of being engaged in anti-sexual behavior. That could be another one. You could pick up an argument, have a fuss about that. White people are looking for black people to do that. Go and start up arguments with other black people about anti-sexual behavior. They can call you a homophobe. Or, hey, he is talking about racism. Even though I don't agree with everything, he is talking about racism. Perhaps I could use this as a bridge to having, or hopefully, communicating with this person and both of us evolving a better and more accurate understanding of racism, white supremacy, as opposed to us having an argument about how dumb and non-constructive this person is. Just a thought. Video is on my YouTube page with accompanying counter-racist material. We will get started. Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, fourth session on the context of white supremacy.
Chapter 2, A Sure Way of Making Enemies and How to Avoid It. When Theodore Roosevelt was in the White House, he confessed that if he could be right 75% of the time, he would reach the highest measure of his expectation. If that was the highest rating that one of the most distinguished men of the 20th century could hope to obtain, what about you and me? If you can be sure of being right only 55% of the time, you can get down to Wall Street and make $1 million a day. If you can't be sure of being right even 55% of the time, why should you tell other people they are wrong? You can tell people they are wrong by a look or an intonation or a gesture, just as eloquently as you can in words. And if you tell them they are wrong, do you make them want to agree with you? Never. For you've struck a direct blow at their intelligence, judgment, pride, and self-respect. That will make them want to strike back, but it will never make them want to change their minds. You may hurl at them all the logic of a Plato or an Immanuel Kant, but you will not alter their opinions, for you have hurt their feelings. Never begin by announcing, "I am going to prove so-and-so to you." Now, that's bad. That's tantamount to saying, "I'm smarter than you are. I'm going to tell you a thing or two and make you change your mind." That is a challenge. It arouses opposition and makes the listener want to battle with you before you even start. It is difficult, under even the most benign conditions, to change people's minds, so why make it harder? Why handicap yourself? If you're going to prove anything, don't let anybody know it. Do it so subtly, so adroitly, that no one will feel that you are doing it. This was expressed succinctly by Alexander Pope. Men must be taught as if you taught them not, and things unknown proposed as things forgot. Over 300 years ago, Galileo said, "You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him to find it within himself." As Lord Chesterfield said to his son, "Be wiser than other people if you can, but do not tell them so." And Socrates said repeatedly to his followers in Athens, "One thing only I know, and that is that I know nothing." Well, I can't hope to be any smarter than Socrates, so I have quit telling people they are wrong, and I find that it pays. If a person makes a statement that you think is wrong, yes, even that you know is wrong, isn't it better to begin by saying, "Well, now, look, I thought otherwise, but I may be wrong. I frequently am. And if I am wrong, I want to be put right. Let's examine the facts." There's magic, positive magic, in such phrases as, "I may be wrong, I frequently am, let's examine the facts." Nobody in the heavens above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters under the earth will ever object to your saying, "I may be wrong, let's examine the facts." One of our class members who used this approach in dealing with customers was Harold Ranke, a Dodge dealer in Billings, Montana. He reported that because of the pressures of the automobile business, he was often hard-boiled and callous when dealing with customers' complaints. This caused flared tempers, loss of business, and general unpleasantness. He told his class, "Recognizing that this was getting me nowhere fast, I tried a new tack. I'd say something like this. Our dealership has made so many mistakes that I'm frequently ashamed. We may have erred in your case, so tell me about it." This approach becomes quite disarming, and by the time the customer releases his feelings, he's usually much more reasonable when it comes to settling the matter. In fact, several customers have thanked me for having such an understanding attitude, and two of them have even brought in friends to buy new cars. In this highly competitive market, we need more of this type of customer, and I believe that showing respect for all customers' opinions and treating them diplomatically and courteously will help beat the competition. You will never get into trouble by admitting that you may be wrong. That will stop all argument and inspire your opponent to be just as fair and open and broad-minded as you are. It will make him want to admit that he, too, may be wrong. If you know positively that a person is wrong, and you bluntly tell him or her so, what happens? Let me illustrate. Mr. S., a young New York attorney, once argued a rather important case before the United States Supreme Court. Lunstgarden versus Fleet Corporation, 280 U.S. 320. The case involved a considerable sum of money and an important question of law. During the argument, one of the Supreme Court justices said to him, "The statute of limitations in admiralty law is 6 years, is it not?" Mr. S. stopped, stared at the justice for a moment, and then he said bluntly, "Your Honor, there is no statute of limitations in admiralty." "A hush fell on the court," said Mr. S., as he related his experience to one of my classes, "and the temperature in the room seemed to drop to zero. I was right, the justice was wrong, and I had told him so. But did that make him friendly? No. I still believe that I had the law on my side, and I know that I spoke better than I ever spoke before, but I didn't persuade. I made the enormous blunder of telling a very learned and famous man that he was wrong." A few people are logical. Most of us are prejudiced and biased. Most of us are blighted with preconceived notions, with jealousy, suspicion, fear, envy, and pride. And most citizens don't want to change their minds about their religion or their haircut or communism or their favorite movie star. So if you're inclined to tell people they're wrong, please review the following paragraph every morning before breakfast. It's from James Harvey Robinson's enlightening book, The Mind in the Making. We sometimes find ourselves changing our minds without any resistance or heavy emotion. But if we are told we are wrong, we resent the imputation and harden our hearts. We are incredibly heedless in the formation of our beliefs, but find ourselves filled with an illicit passion for them when anyone proposes to rob us of their companionship. It is obviously not the ideas themselves that are dear to us, but our self-esteem which is threatened. The little word, my, is the most important one in human affairs, and properly to reckon with, it is the beginning of wisdom. It has the same force whether it is my dinner, my dog, and my house, or my father, my country, and my God. We not only resent the imputation that our watch is wrong or our car shabby, but that our conception of the canals of Mars, of the pronunciation of Epictetus, of the medicinal value of Salicin, or of the date of Sargon I is subject to revision. We like to continue to believe what we have been accustomed to accept as true, and the resentment aroused when doubt is cast upon any of our assumptions leads us to seek every manner of excuse for clinging to it. The result is that most of our so-called reasoning consist in finding arguments for going on believing as we already do. Carl Rogers, the eminent psychologist, wrote in his book, On Becoming a Person, I have found it of enormous value when I can permit myself to understand the other person. The way in which I have worded this statement may seem strange to you. Is it necessary to permit oneself to understand another? I think it is. Our first reaction to most of the statements which we hear from other people is an evaluation or judgment rather than an understanding of it. When someone expresses some feeling, attitude, or belief, our tendency is almost immediately to feel, that's right, or that's stupid, that's abnormal, that's unreasonable, that's incorrect, that's not nice. Very rarely do we permit ourselves to understand precisely what the meaning of the statement is to the other person. I once employed an interior decorator to make some draperies for my home. When the bill arrived, I was dismayed. A few days later, a friend dropped in and looked at the draperies. The price was mentioned, and she exclaimed with a note of triumph, "What? That's awful! I'm afraid he put one over on you." True? Yes, she told the truth. But few people like to listen to truths that reflect on their judgment. So, being human, I tried to defend myself. I pointed out that the best is eventually the cheapest, that one can't expect to get quality and artistic taste at bargain basement prices, and so on. The next day, another friend dropped in, admired the draperies, bubbled over with enthusiasm, and expressed a wish that she could afford such exquisite creations for her home. My reaction was totally different. "Well, to tell you the truth," I said, "I can't afford them myself. I paid too much. I'm sorry I ordered them." When we're wrong, we may admit it to ourselves, and if we're handled gently and tactfully, we may admit it to others, and even take pride in our frankness and broad-mindedness. But not if someone else is trying to ram the unpalatable fact down our esophagus. Horace Greeley, the most famous editor in America during the time of the Civil War, disagreed violently with Lincoln's policies. He believed that he could drive Lincoln into agreeing with him by a campaign of argument, ridicule, and abuse. He waged this bitter campaign month after month, year after year. In fact, he wrote a brutal, bitter, sarcastic, and personal attack on President Lincoln the night Booth shot him. But did all this bitterness make Lincoln agree with Greeley? Not at all. Ridicule and abuse never do. If you want some excellent suggestions about dealing with people and managing yourself and improving your personality, read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, one of the most fascinating life stories ever written, one of the classics of American literature. Ben Franklin tells how he conquered the iniquitous habit of argument and transformed himself into one of the most able, suave, and diplomatic men in American history. One day, when Ben Franklin was a blundering youth, an old Quaker friend took him aside and lashed him with a few stinging truths, something like this. "Ben, you are impossible. Your opinions have a slap in them for everyone who differs with you. They have become so offensive that nobody cares for them. Your friends find they enjoy themselves better when you are not around. You know so much that no man can tell you anything. Indeed, no man is going to try, for the effort would lead only to discomfort and hard work. So you are not likely ever to know any more than you do now, which is very little." One of the finest things I know about Ben Franklin is the way he accepted that smarting rebuke. He was big enough and wise enough to realize that it was true, to sense that he was headed for failure and social disaster. So he made a right-about face. He began immediately to change his insolent, opinionated ways. "I made it a rule," said Franklin, "to forbear all direct contradiction to the sentiment of others, and all positive assertion of my own. I even forbade myself the use of every word or expression in the language that imported a fixed opinion, such as certainly, undoubtedly, etc., and I adopted instead of them, I conceive, I apprehend, or I imagine a thing to be so, or it so appears to me at present. When another asserted something that I thought an error, I denied myself the pleasure of contradicting him abruptly, and of showing immediately some absurdity in his proposition, and in answering, I began by observing that in certain cases of circumstances his opinion would be right, but in the present case there appeared, or seemed to me, some difference, etc. I soon found the advantage of this change in my manner. The conversations I engaged in went on more pleasantly. The modest way in which I proposed my opinions procured them a readier reception and less contradiction. I had less mortification when I was found to be in the wrong, and I more easily prevailed with others to give up their mistakes and join with me when I happened to be in the right. And this mode, which I at first put on with some violence to natural inclination, became at length so easy and so habitual to me that perhaps for these 50 years no one has ever heard a dogmatical expression escape me. And to this habit, after my character of integrity, I think it principally owing that I had earned so much weight with my fellow citizens when I proposed new institutions or alterations in the old, and so much influence in public councils when I became a member. For I was but a bad speaker, never eloquent, subject to much hesitation in my choice of words, hardly correct in language, and yet I generally carried my points. How did Ben Franklin's methods work in business? Let's take two examples. Catherine A. Allred of Kings Mountain, North Carolina, is an industrial engineering supervisor for a yarn processing plant. She told one of our classes how she handled a sensitive problem before and after taking our training. "Part of my responsibility," she reported, "deals with setting up and maintaining incentive systems and standards for our operators so they can make more money by producing more yarn. The system we were using had worked fine when we had only two or three different types of yarn, but recently we had expanded our inventory and capabilities to enable us to run more than 12 different varieties. The present system was no longer adequate to pay the operators fairly for the work being performed and give them an incentive to increase production. I had worked up a new system which would enable us to pay the operator by the class of yarn she was running at any one particular time. With my new system in hand, I entered the meeting, determined to prove to the management that my system was the right approach. I told them in detail how they were wrong and showed where they were being unfair and how I had all the answers they needed. To say the least, I failed miserably. I had become so busy defending my position on the new system that I had left them no opening to graciously admit their problems on the old one. The issue was dead. After several sessions of this course, I realized all too well where I had made my mistakes. I called another meeting, and this time I asked where they felt their problems were. We discussed each point, and I asked them their opinion on which was the best way to proceed. with a few low-keyed suggestions at proper intervals, I let them develop my system by themselves. At the end of the meeting, when I actually presented my system, they enthusiastically accepted it. I'm convinced now that nothing good is accomplished and a lot of damage can be done if you tell a person straight out that he or she is wrong. You only succeed in stripping that person of self-dignity and making yourself an unwelcome part of any discussion. Let's take another example. And remember, these cases I'm citing are typical of the experiences of thousands of other people. R.V. Crowley was a salesman for a lumber company in New York. Crowley admitted that he had been telling hard-boiled lumber inspectors for years that they were wrong. And he'd won the arguments, too, but it hadn't done any good. "For these lumber inspectors," said Mr. Crowley, "are like baseball umpires. Once they make a decision, they never change it." Mr. Crowley saw that his firm was losing thousands of dollars through the arguments he won. So while taking my course, he resolved to change tactics and abandon arguments. And with what results? Here's the story, as he told it to fellow members of his class. One morning the phone rang in my office. A hot and bothered person at the other end proceeded to inform me that a car of lumber we had shipped into his plant was entirely unsatisfactory. His firm had stopped unloading and requested that we make immediate arrangements to remove the stock from their yard. After about one-fourth of the car had been unloaded, their lumber inspector reported that the lumber was running 55% below grade. Under the circumstances, they refused to accept it. I immediately started for his plant, and on the way turned over in my mind the best way to handle the situation. Ordinarily, under such circumstances, I should have quoted grading rules and tried, as a result of my own experience and knowledge as a lumber inspector, to convince the other inspector that the lumber was actually up to grade and that he was misinterpreting the rules in his inspection. However, I thought I would apply the principles learned in this training. When I arrived at the plant, I found the purchasing agent and the lumber inspector in a wicked humor, both set for an argument and a fight. We walked out to the car that was being unloaded, and I requested that they continue to unload so that I could see how things were going. I asked the inspector to go right ahead and lay out the rejects, as he had been doing, and to put the good pieces in another pile. After watching him for a while, it began to dawn on me that his inspection actually was much too strict and that he was misinterpreting the rules. This particular lumber was white pine, and I knew the inspector was thoroughly schooled in hardwoods, but not a competent, experienced inspector on white pine. A white pine happens to be my own strong suit, but did I offer any objection to the way he was grading the lumber? None whatever. I kept on watching, and gradually began to ask questions as to why certain pieces were not satisfactory. I didn't for one instant insinuate that the inspector was wrong. I emphasized that my only reason for asking was in order that we could give his firm exactly what they wanted in future shipment. By asking questions in a very friendly, cooperative spirit, and insisting continually that they were right in laying out boards not satisfactory to their purpose, I got him warmed up, and the strained relations between us began to thaw and melt away. An occasional carefully put remark on my part gave birth to the idea in his mind that possibly some of these rejected pieces were actually within the grade that they had bought, and that their requirements demanded a more expensive grade. I was very careful, however, not to let him think I was making an issue of this point. Gradually, his whole attitude changed. He finally admitted to me that he was not experienced on white pine, and began to ask me questions about each piece as it came out of the car. I'd explain why such and such a piece came within the grade specified, but kept on insisting that we did not want him to take it if it was unsuitable for their purpose. He finally got to the point where he felt guilty every time he put a piece in the rejected pile. And at last he saw that the mistake was on their part, for not having specified as good a grade as they needed. The ultimate outcome was that he went through the entire carload again after I left, accepted the whole lot, and we received a check in full. In that one instance alone, a little tact and the determination to refrain from telling the other man he was wrong saved my company a substantial amount of cash, and it would be hard to place a money value on the goodwill that was saved. Martin Luther King was asked how, as a pacifist, he could be an admirer of Air Force General Daniel Chappie James, then the nation's highest-ranking black officer. Dr. King replied, "I judge people by their own principles, not by my own." In a similar way, General Robert E. Lee once spoke to the President of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, in the most glowing terms about a certain officer under his command. Another officer in attendance was astonished. "General," he said, "do you not know that the man of whom you speak so highly is one of your bitterest enemies who misses no opportunity to malign you?" "Yes," replied General Lee, "but the President asked my opinion of him. He did not ask for his opinion of me." By the way, I'm not revealing anything new in this chapter. 2,000 years ago, Jesus said, "Agree with thine adversary quickly." And 2,200 years before Christ was born, King Akhtoy of Egypt gave his son some shrewd advice, advice that is sorely needed today. "Be diplomatic," counseled the king. "It will help you gain your point." In other words, don't argue with your customer or your spouse or your adversary. Don't tell them they are wrong. Don't get them stirred up. Use a little diplomacy. Principle 2. Show respect for the other person's opinions. Never say, "You're wrong." Chapter 3. If you're wrong, admit it. Within a minute's walk of my house, there was a wild stretch of virgin timber where the blackberry thickets foamed white in the springtime, where the squirrels nested and reared their young, and the horse weeds grew as tall as a horse's head. This unspoiled woodland was called Forest Park, and it was a forest, probably not much different in appearance from what it was when Columbus discovered America. I frequently walked in this park with Rex, my little Boston bulldog. He was a friendly, harmless little hound, and since we rarely met anyone in the park, I took Rex along without a leash or muzzle. One day, we encountered a mounted policeman in the park, a policeman itching to show his authority. "What do you mean by letting that dog run loose in the park without a muzzle and leash?" he reprimanded me. "Don't you know it's against the law?" "Well, yes, I know it is," I replied softly, "but I didn't think he'd do any harm out there." "You didn't think. You didn't think. The law doesn't give a tinker's damn about what you think. That dog might kill a squirrel or bite a child. Oh, I'm going to let you off this time, but if I catch this dog out here again without a muzzle and leash, you'll have to tell it to the judge." I meekly promised to obey, and I did obey for a few times. But Rex didn't like the muzzle, and neither did I, so we decided to take a chance. Everything was lovely for a while, and then we struck a snag. Rex and I raced over the brow of a hill one afternoon, and there, suddenly, to my dismay, I saw the majesty of the law astride a bay horse. Rex was out in front, heading straight for the officer. I was in for it. I knew it. So I didn't wait until the policeman started talking. I beat him to it. I said, "Officer, you've caught me red-handed. I'm guilty. I have no alibis, no excuses. You warned me last week that if I brought the dog out here again without a muzzle, you'd fine me." "Well, now," the policeman responded in a soft tone, "I know it's a temptation to let a little dog like that have a run out here when nobody's around." "Sure, it's a temptation," I replied, "but it is against the law." "Well, a little dog like that isn't going to harm anybody," the policeman remonstrated. "Well, no, but he may kill squirrels," I said. "Well, now I think you're taking this a bit too seriously," he told me. "I'll tell you what you do. You just let him run over the hill there where I can't see him, and we'll forget all about it." Now, that policeman, being human, wanted a feeling of importance. So when I began to condemn myself, the only way he could nourish his self-esteem was to take the magnanimous attitude of showing mercy. But suppose I'd tried to defend myself. Well, did you ever argue with a policeman? But instead of breaking lances with him, I admitted that he was absolutely right and I was absolutely wrong. I admitted it quickly, openly, and with enthusiasm. The affair terminated graciously in my taking his side and his taking my side. Lord Chesterfield himself could hardly have been more gracious than this mounted policeman who only a week previously had threatened to have the law on me. If we know we are going to be rebuked anyhow, isn't it far better to beat the other person to it and do it ourselves? Isn't it much easier to listen to self-criticism than to bear condemnation from alien lips? Say about yourself all the derogatory things you know the other person is thinking, or wants to say, or intends to say, and say them before that person has a chance to say them. The chances are 100 to 1 that a generous, forgiving attitude will be taken, and your mistakes will be minimized, just as the mounted policeman did with me and Rex. Ferdinand E. Warren, a commercial artist, used this technique to win the goodwill of a petulant, scolding buyer of art. It is important in making drawings for advertising and publishing purposes to be precise and very exact, Mr. Warren said as he told the story. Some art editors demand that their commissions be executed immediately, and in these cases some slight error is liable to occur. I knew one art director in particular who was always delighted to find fault with some little thing. I have often left his office in disgust, not because of the criticism, but because of his method of attack. Recently, I delivered a rush job to this editor, and he phoned me to call at his office immediately. He said something was wrong. When I arrived, I found just what I had anticipated and dreaded. He was hostile, gloating over his chance to criticize. He demanded with heat why I had done so-and-so. My opportunity had come to apply the self-criticism I'd been studying about, so I said, "Mr. So-and-so, if what you say is true, I am at fault, and there is absolutely no excuse for my blunder. I have been doing drawings for you long enough to know better. I am ashamed of myself." Immediately, he started to defend me. "Yes, you're right, but after all, this isn't a serious mistake. It's only," and I interrupted him, "any mistake," I said, "may be costly, and they're all irritating." He started to break in, but I wouldn't let him. I was having a grand time. For the first time in my life, I was criticizing myself, and I loved it. "I should have been more careful," I continued. "You give me a lot of work, and you deserve the best, so I'm going to do this drawing all over." "No, no," he protested, "I wouldn't think of putting you to all that trouble." He praised my work, assured me he wanted only a minor change, and that my slight error hadn't cost his firm any money, and after all, it was a mere detail not worth worrying about. My eagerness to criticize myself took all the fight out of him. He ended up by taking me to lunch, and before we parted, he gave me a check and another commission. There's a certain degree of satisfaction in having the courage to admit one's errors. It not only clears the air of guilt and defensiveness, but often helps solve the problem created by the error. Bruce Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, had incorrectly authorized payment of full wages to an employee on sick leave. When he discovered his error, he brought it to the attention of the employee and explained that to correct the mistake, he would have to reduce his next paycheck by the entire amount of the overpayment. The employee pleaded that as that would cause him a serious financial problem, could the money be repaid over a period of time? In order to do this, Harvey explained, he would have to obtain his supervisor's approval. "And this, I knew," reported Harvey, "would result in a boss-type explosion." While trying to decide how to handle the situation better, I realized that the whole mess was my fault, and I would have to admit it to my boss. I walked into his office, told him that I had made a mistake, and then informed him of the complete facts. He replied, in an explosive manner, that it was the fault of their personnel department. I repeated that it was my fault. He exploded again about carelessness in the accounting department. Again, I explained it was my fault. He blamed 2 other people in the office, but each time I reiterated that it was my fault. Finally, he looked at me and said, "Okay, it was your fault. Now straighten it out." The error was corrected, and nobody got into trouble. I felt great, because I was able to handle a tense situation and had the courage not to seek alibis. My boss has had more respect for me ever since. Any fool can try to defend his or her mistakes, and most fools do. But it raises one above the herd and gives one a feeling of nobility and exultation to admit one's mistakes. For example, one of the most beautiful things that history records about Robert E. Lee is the way he blamed himself and only himself for the failure of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Pickett's charge was undoubtedly the most brilliant and picturesque attack that ever occurred in the Western world. General George E. Pickett himself was picturesque. He wore his hair so long that his auburn locks almost touched his shoulders, and, like Napoleon in his Italian campaigns, he wrote ardent love letters almost daily while on the battlefield. His devoted troops cheered him that tragic July afternoon as he rode off jauntily toward the Union lines, his cap set at a rakish angle over his right ear. They cheered, and they followed him, man touching man, rank pressing rank, with banners flying and bayonets gleaming in the sun. It was a gallant sight, daring, magnificent. A murmur of admiration ran through the Union lines as they beheld it. Pickett's troops swept forward at an easy trot, through orchard and cornfield, across a meadow and over a ravine. All the time, the enemy's cannon was tearing ghastly holes in their ranks, but on they pressed, grim, irresistible. Suddenly, the Union infantry rose from behind the stone wall on Cemetery Ridge, where they had been hiding, and fired volley after volley into Pickett's onrushing troops. The crest of the hill was a sheet of flame, a slaughterhouse, a blazing volcano. In a few minutes, all of Pickett's brigade commanders except one were down, and four-fifths of his 5,000 men had fallen. General Lewis A. Armistead, leading the troops in the final plunge, ran forward, vaulted over the stone wall, and waving his cap on top of his sword, shouted, "Give 'em steel, boys!" They did. They leaped over the wall, bayoneted their enemies, smashed skulls with clubbed muskets, and planted the battle flags of the South on Cemetery Ridge. The banner waved there only for a moment, but that moment, brief as it was, recorded the high water mark of the Confederacy. Pickett's charge, brilliant, heroic, was nevertheless the beginning of the end. Lee had failed. He could not penetrate the North, and he knew it. The South was doomed. Lee was so saddened, so shocked, that he sent in his resignation and asked Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, to appoint a younger, abler man. If Lee had wanted to blame the disastrous failure of Pickett's charge on someone else, he could have found a score of alibis. Some of his division commanders had failed him. The cavalry hadn't arrived in time to support the infantry attack. This had gone wrong, and that had gone awry. But Lee was far too noble to blame others. As Pickett's beaten and bloody troops struggled back to the Confederate lines, Robert E. Lee rode out to meet them all alone and greeted them with a self-condemnation that was little short of sublime. "All this has been my fault," he confessed. "I, and I alone, have lost this battle." Few generals in all history had had the courage and character to admit that.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The tiny.cc/oneRace, and that's the number one, tiny.cc/oneRace. That works as well if you want to use the flash phone, if you want to download the app, use your smartphone or mobile device if you want to participate. I will get to the folks that have hands up. I'll get to them first and save my comments for later. The only thing I will say, I have commented before about timing, and it is pretty incredible timing that we have
on the cows. It has happened over and over and over again. Really incredible just how things have worked out frequently, where we were doing a program that happened to coincide. I think just one example, I'm trying to think of another illustration off the top of my head. Dorothy Roberts, who I adore, black female. She was a professor at Northwestern. She is now with the University of Pennsylvania. She wrote Shattered Bonds. It's on racism in the foster care system. And she was on the program in July. Whoa. Timing. I mean, this is right. I pulled this round. I wasn't even that. I was just trying to think of, I thought this is the most mundane example. It just so happens that this is almost 3 years to the day that Dorothy Roberts was on the program for the second time, and we discussed Shattered Bonds, racism in the foster care system. And it just so happened that that night, this was a Sunday, that night, the Boondocks, they had an episode. It was the one where Granddad starts smoking cannabis and he gets arrested and he goes to court and the judge threatens him, because I think he gets arrested twice. And the judge threatens him. He said, I'm going to take your children and I'm going to put them in foster care. And I think it was quite a few listeners. They were like, oh my God, we were just talking about how horribly racist that system is. And that's like one of the worst things imaginable, to be a black child in foster care under white supremacy. But at any rate, so that's July 2010. Our timing continues. They mentioned Pickett's Charge, the Battle of Gettysburg. This is the 150-year anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. White people have been doing reenactments and talking about, I just listened to like a 15-minute segment where they were talking about the Battle of Gettysburg. And I mean, why? The timing of the cows, impeccable, significant, I would add. The folks that dialed in, we should have the person that dialed in from a blocked number, person that dialed in 9325, and I think this might be me, B Moore. Your three lines are all open.
Keith, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, mine are going to be really short, but Peace Guns and all the other. The first thing, referring to the segment about not telling people they're wrong, even if you're certain that they are, that segment reminded me so much of you, Gus, when you say things like, I may be incorrect. So that reminded me of you. The second thing, where they were talking about, if you're wrong, admit it, basically condemning yourself. I'm a psychology major, and that kind of made me think of reverse psychology. But
yeah, that's all I have to say for now.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Do you want to handle, since you're regular participant, I'm really uncouth with that, and that's in the book. Do you want to handle, how do you want to be referenced?
We started out with Demery 4. I mean, that's good.
Demery 4. There we go.
Okay, my first point, I'm going to start with a sure way of making enemies, how to avoid. I like the illustration about Mr. R.V. Crowley. He was a salesman for the lumber company, always bragging about, you know, how many lumber inspectors that he had told off. And it finally dawned on him that his tactics was losing his company money. So I guess he was going to ride down to check out the situation that they were having with a delivery. So on his way down there, he thought he'd change his tactics. And I think he tried what I would call differential negotiation. Instead of trying to win in a contest of wills, he tried to reach out and to get some results based on standards that was independent of wheels. So having an open mind and allowing the customer to come to a conclusion himself, he was able to practice that old adage, the customer's always right. So using diplomacy and never say to the other person that they were wrong. You know, and, you know, if you think about that, that's good. But then if you add, but admit quickly when you are wrong, that makes it even more difficult. But I kind of summed it up in counter-racism. When I think talking to a person, well, when we as less confused non-white people attempt to win the confidence of those that may be a little more confused than we are, and we fail to realize the effects of cognitive dissonance. When someone knows that there's something wrong, but they refuse to admit it, because when they admit the problem, that would require some action. And people usually take the path of least resistance, which would basically amount to a lack of self-respect. And we all know that self-respect is more powerful than a weapon of mass destruction. So, consider the situation from the other person's perspective and show the person some respect. And I'll give someone else a chance to talk. I better have some more commentary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Good to hear from you, 909.
Greetings, Gus. Yeah, man. I think it's significant that you were saying timing and whatnot, you know, the cows. Before you said that, you know, you were saying you were giving your comments or whatever. And while you were talking, I was like, man, you know, I was like, here you go again, about to take my comment. You know what I'm saying? I'm not really upset, but, you know, just thinking like, okay, you know, he said he was going to reserve his comments, and then, you know, he's about to steal my comment. But you didn't, though, you didn't. Not altogether, but I think I was going to comment on, you know, the part where he was talking about the dog, you know, the dog in the park or whatever. I was thinking about this, you know, we just had this guy in Hawthorne out here. The police shot his dog, you know what I'm saying? And I was like, wow, you know, here you got this case over here. This dude gets arrested, gets his dog shot and killed in front of him. And, you know, you have the piece of this, you know, everybody's talking about it and sad about it and everything like that. But you see, you know, this author is giving the example of how not to get your dog shot in front of you. You know what I'm saying? I just thought that was, like, oh, you know, as far as timing, I just thought that was like good timing, because people were, you know, tripping on that particular incident or whatever. Did you hear about that?
Someone put the video on my Facebook page. I didn't follow it as intensely, but I think it was a while ago too, wasn't it? Like 4 days ago, 4 or 5 days
mm-hmm.
ago. Yeah. Or relative, not a while ago, but I mean 4 or 5 days.
I mean, I didn't watch it or nothing, because, you know, I didn't want to see a dog get shot. But I was reading some of the incident and how he did everything wrong. He was having a, you know, man, you know, he was like, have you ever argued with, you know, the author or something, have you ever argued with a cop, you know? And, you know, he's out there arguing with the police. I mean, he's like, and you see what happens, so. Yeah, I think that, you know, the game, you know, people, some people hold true to this, you know what I'm saying? And they say the game is to be sold, not to be told, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of people grow up with that in their mind, you know, and I just feel like you're giving, you know, this is it's informative. I think if people really, you know, see it, we have all these examples and whatnot that he's given, and we have an example of you know, somebody getting a dog shot, and you know, this dude's commenting on the dog, and you know, it's just it's just one of the things I think is you know, it's cool about the cows or whatever. I think the synchronicity, you said timing, but I think like that sync, some people say synchronicity. I don't know if that's a philosophy or whatever. I just heard that term before. I'm not into the philosophy of it because I don't know it, but I just heard that term. But I think it's, I think it does say something about the cows. You know, I think we should be, you know, in anything that we're dealing with, I think an indication is if it's ahead of the curve, you know, if it's correct or whatever, it's ahead of the curve. It can answer questions before they're asked and things like that. So I think people should take that for what it's worth also. And I was just thinking about Benjamin Franklin. Well, I was thinking about the word tact, and, you know, having tact or whatnot. That's important, you know.
What do you mean when you say tact?
Well, I was gonna say I have it short for tactic, but at the same time, I have it to where it's tactile, like feelings, you know what I'm saying? This is just my definition or whatever. But having a sense of using your senses, you know, and being aware of the situation, you know what I'm saying? There's a time and place for everything. So yeah, you know, a tactic and using your senses, you know, tactile, your you know, things that you, your instruments of you know, your detecting instruments or your sensing instruments, you know, taste, touch, sight, and all that, all those things.
Do you think victims of racism fail to use their senses and to use the information that you could collect from those senses to help them navigate when they're in contact with other victims of racism?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what I talk, you know, there's almost not a day go by where I'm trying to get people to, even yesterday, I can give an example. Yesterday, I'm in the gym, and I'm kind of showing somebody, you know, how to correctly do this at one exercise or whatever. And it was just a simple correction, you know, I just told them that they had to, you know, to straighten their wrist. And when I said that, you know, when they did it, they had a better response. They didn't feel like, you know, the irritation and whatnot, you know, leading to pain or whatever. But when I said that, I thought of Dr. Welsing, and I don't know if she said this or not, but I just remember somehow, I don't know if I'm remembering correctly or not, but she said something about they might say he has a weak wrist. I mean, like, I heard her voice, like, in my mind, like maybe not even a minute past, you know, when I said straighten your wrist or whatever. And I just heard Dr. Rosa say, you might say that he has a weak wrist. And, you know, that wrist being you know, like if that person was observing themselves or whatever, they would have noticed, like, that's a break. You know, that, you know, your wrist is weak. You know, that's so, it's just, it was just so many associations were made in my mind pertaining to that. Like when you see somebody, a male or whatever, and his wrist is broken or weak, in exercising, that leads to imbalances, you know, in the body. You can, you know, that having your wrist being weak like that will lead to imbalances in your body, and will can cause a major injury just having, you know, throughout the body, not just the wrist and the arm, but, you know, all the way down to the groin, the left side of your, you know, if it's the right wrist, then the left side of your leg and things like that. So I was like, wow, that is an indicator, you know. So I always try to get people to be aware, be aware of their senses. That's all we have, is our senses. You know, like on some level, like that is one of our major tools as human, you know, as human beings, is our senses. So we've been taught, you know, not to use our senses. So, man, I don't know how high I will put it up there, but I think it's almost at the top, that we do not use our basic, the tools that we have, which is our senses, to, you know, to, you know, start, you know, getting the information and you know, your observations and things like that. Like, man, yeah, so that's a big problem. People don't see nothing. Mr. Fuller talks about that all the time. People walk down the street, there's all kind of stuff growing. They don't see nothing. They don't know what they don't see. It's like, man, their eyes open. You don't see. You don't taste anything. You swallow your food extra fast. So like, this is a big problem. I mean, like, we've been taken out of the human family. Like that's what we've been given as tools, is our five senses, and we don't use them.
Context of white supremacy. I guess I would. You can maybe just classify all these as senses. Depends on, you know, what one means when one uses the term sense or senses. But if you take what 909 shared, and I think at the very beginning that CBS segment on How to Win Friends, and they were saying this stuff seems like, you know, common sense. And the guy from the Carnegie Institute, he responded, yes, many of the suggestions seem like common sense, but they are not common practice. And I think it's cliche that common sense is not so common. Unfortunately, I think that is a big part of our victimization. So if you don't have just your basic senses, you don't have common sense. And then you take this passage. I don't have the page numbers because I have the ebook. So, you know, but he said, few people are logical. I would amplify that, unfortunately, for victims of racism. We're even less logical, I would say, unfortunately. Most of us are prejudiced and biased. Most of us are blighted with preconceived notions, with jealousy, suspicion, fear, envy, and pride. I mean, that is white pathology from a white man. And most citizens don't want to change their minds about their religion, strongest religion, white supremacy, or their haircut, or communism, or their favorite movie star. So if you are inclined to tell people they are wrong, please read the following paragraph every morning before breakfast. It is from James Harvey Robinson's enlightening book, The Mind in the Making. I won't go on to read the whole paragraph, even though that section is very good, again, just about, you know, why you don't want to be going out, particularly for victims. I mean, again, I can only amplify, he was writing this book for white people. So if racist man, racist woman, the master terrorists of the universe, if they don't like being told that they're wrong, if they feel bad and self-conscious about being told that they're wrong, I can't even imagine how many times that would be magnified for people who are told that your DNA is wrong, your hair is not wrong, your nose is wrong, your feeble mind, everything about you and your entire existence of you and your whole group of people is an error that should be blighted from the planet. I mean, that's what black people have been told forever. Non-white people, black people especially. You can only imagine, you know, how much worse that is to then for the 50th time that hour to be told, oh, and by the way, you're wrong about this too. Definitely want to keep that in mind, I hope, for victims of racism and encouraging us all to be patient, myself included, because I'm trying to improve on this myself. I'll mute my line. That does bear repeating, though. He was writing for white people and saying few people are logical. If he's writing for a white audience saying that few white people are logical, again, I would, and that's part of our victimization. White people have done this to us. Non-white people, victims of racism, are terribly illogical. I'm even reminded of Dr. Kambon when he says he thinks the reason that whites call us disadvantaged is because when you are lacking information, particularly when you have an enemy and your enemy has information that you don't, you are at a disadvantage. That's exactly how he explained his brain computer processed white people calling us disadvantaged, not logical. I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to give a little anecdote here. I think that this book is really for action. You know, if you understand the principles, you can try them. I've been trying them. I tried it in a restaurant. One of the waitresses wasn't being attentive, you know, to my wife and I. So my wife was getting a little upset. But then when we finally got her attention, you know, I said, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, you know, would you mind bringing me a glass of water? And, you know, just using that little tip from the book, I mean, her whole attitude changed. She was very attentive to us, and my wife was already intent on not tipping her. But, I mean, she really earned a tip from that point on. And I was starting to think that, you know, if you think about it, if they're acting as of some service, they never get treated, you know, as a human being. So if you show any little bit of kindness, there's some reaction to it. And I just wanted to share that. And also, the principals have taught me that I had an injury on the job, and the supervisor did not want to fill out the proper forms. He said that he knew that didn't call for that. And so I went head-to-head with him in opposition to him. Turned out I was right, and he ended up having to do all the forms. But then it created adversity that has been going on for over a year now. And sometimes, you know, just by learning these principles, there probably was a better way that I could have done that and got the same results without going head to head with the guy and showing him up in front of the other workers. So I just wanted to, you know, share that with the caller.
Thank you for the anecdote. I'm not surprised. I have seen that. I have seen similar results, just, you know, using those sort of words. That's one of many things that stood out about Mr. Fuller, just to, again, you can get his books, The Code or The Word Guide, producejustice.com. But that was one of the initial things that stood out to me about Mr. Fuller. That's one of the things I hope that, you know, stands out about the cows. I feel like, you know, frequently when you hear people, or at least I speak for myself, when I hear people talk about racism, white supremacy, for most of my time on the planet, it gets very emotional. It's name calling. It's not a calm, courteous exchange. Rarely, very rarely. And with Mr. Fuller, I got that from Malcolm X, even though he did do a lot of name calling at first, but he could also be very calm, rational, you know, just breaking things down. But with Mr. Fuller, he would be saying, sir, ma'am, even doing this with white people. And that really stood out to me, just like, wow, like, even, you know, he's saying racist suspect and all that, but he's still ma'am, sir. Like, even when I would hear him say Adolf Hitler, he would say Mr. or, you know, that same, just being courteous, be courteous with everyone. And that, I feel like that's something that can be employed, because I think when you get in a habit of doing that, then I think you are less likely to slip. Even when you, when there are disagreements and you might be frustrated, you're less likely to easily slip into the name calling and the put downs and just little slights and insults, the profanities. That's another one. Try to minimize the cursing. That was something I had a long history getting my four-letter words in, but I really do make an effort, even obviously on the program, I make an effort to have a G-rated, but even when I'm not on the program, just not having a lot of profanity, just because I found that it tends towards being very lax about words and lax about name calling. And I've just found that can easily, when you are around people who are toxic, anti-blackness is rife, it can just easily go off the rails. And so just really making that effort to be courteous, I think it sets a great example, and particularly when you're talking about racism. Also, for an anecdote, then I'll mute my line, they gave an example in the book about being quick to admit that you're wrong, if you did something incorrect, to acknowledge it, and, you know, that it can pay off for you. That can be true. I still employ that. That can be true. My one point of caution, though, because he said, you know, who could get upset with a person for saying, hey, I could be wrong, or I could have made a mistake. And I said, oh, I got a story right there, because that has happened to me. When I first started talking publicly about racism, I was having conversation with one of the most refined racist suspects. His name is Eric Hamilton. He's here in the Pacific Northwest. Excuse me, Matthew Hamilton. Matthew Hamilton. He went to Brown. He went to Notre Dame. He was sexually sewering a non-white person. He was one of those anti-racists, just disgusting. But this guy was with a whole bunch of other non-white people. I think he was the only white person in this group. And I was the only person who was less confused and saw through what he was doing. And he was spreading rumors. I mean, he was working his magic. Like, he had all of them hated me before they even knew me, because he had done so much work in advance. Like, as soon as he saw me, he was like, oh my God, this nigga is less confused. Gotta make sure everybody else hates this nigga. Incredible experience. But anyway, we're talking about this book, C.L.R. James. I think his name has come up on the program before, Black Male. He wrote about racism, white supremacy in the Caribbean. He wrote about the Haitian Revolution, Black Jacobins, I think 1804, or I hope she knows about it. If she doesn't, there's a homework assignment for her. Black Jacobins, C.L.R. James, he married a white person. Anyway, we were talking about this book, and I was saying, because he uses a phrase where he said that mulatto class, that they were aping the former slave masters. And I was just like, I don't really like, or that's a concern for me, using the term aping, saying that non-white people are aping white people, because white people have referenced us as apes a lot. And so it was like the non-white people there were huge fans of C.L.R. James. And I wasn't talking bad about him. I just said, you know, that is a concern for me. That's in the book. But, you know, he's a victim of racism. That was all it was going to be. But they got really upset. Like, I was trying to tar their hero. And so they're jumping up and down. And it is an intimidating thing to have a whole lot of people coming at you at once. And so I said, you know, hey, I could be wrong. I'm not. And it was just immediate, like, oh, my God. I can't believe he would say I could be wrong. He was just like, wow, I've never. And that's what I would do now. Just that right there would be a huge sign. If you're in an environment where someone gets angry at you saying I could be wrong, you automatically, okay, these are people that are not interested in friendly exchange. They've already come to an opinion about me or whatever the case may be. there's not a reason for me to say a lot. I mean, that's really rare, and that's telling you a lot about those individuals. But Gus T. Renegade can say that I have been in a situation where people got upset for me saying I could be wrong. I shared that experience with Mr. Fuller, and he had the most hilarious response. He said, that is exactly what I've been talking about. Minimize conflict. He said, non-white people, we look forward to getting in arguments. We look forward to criticizing other black people. He said, that same victim of racism, if you had told him that, hey, I'm right, I'm smart, he said, you look like a dumb MF to me. I don't see what's so smart about you. Like, you just, I mean, when you realize that's what it is, it's anti-blackness, and, you know, I'm just not going to be able to do anything about that. That's a part of our victimization. You just let that one go and keep it moving as best you can. Minimize contact. Minimize conflict. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, that's a hostile environment. I wanted to bring up just on the who, what, when, where, why, and how. Who he brought up? Benjamin Franklin. If you guys haven't read his autobiography, man, you got to do it. I mean, you're talking about a super refined, racist suspect. So, you know, he was white, and he was, man, this dude, super refined. But I'm talking super refined. So, like, yeah, he employed a lot of tactics to get what he wanted. One of the things he, if you guys want to read that, if you haven't, that's excellent, excellent. But one of the things he did also, he would dress like people that, like, he wasn't really associated with. I can't really remember if they were Quakers. I'm not sure. I think they might have been Quakers. Were they Quakers? I'm not sure. But he would dress like the Quaker, but he wasn't no Quaker. You know, if I'm getting that correct, I could be incorrect as far as if it was Quakers or not. But when I read that, I said, wow, that's interesting, because I still do it to this day. But I would, before I even read that out of his book, I would do that. I would dress in a way where people wouldn't know who they did. They would be like, where are you from? And I'm like, I'm born and raised, you know, I'm like, I'm from here, you know, I'm from LA, born and raised. And they were like, wow, you look like, and I was like, that was my goal. You know what I'm saying? That was my goal. That was my intention, is for people not to, like, just automatically recognize, where I'm from and whatnot. But, the thing is that you have a goal in mind, or if, you know, somebody, you know, if you're trying to make money, just or it could be anything, but, like, you have a goal. So, like, you're going to be telling people, like, you're trying to, that's what you have to keep in mind. You know, there's a time and place for everything. Like, you know, you're trying to get money from somebody, and you correcting them, telling them, oh, no, whatever, or I just think that don't lose the purpose of what you're doing. I mean, one time, almost, you know, I was about to be fired, and my main thing was, because I was cool, you know, at this job. I didn't want to lose it, so that was like my main focus. So I was, you know, the reason why I got fired is because I was being kind of guided by the lead. He was a black male, and he would, you know, he took a liking to me and everything like that, and he was my lead, but he wasn't the head of the department, and the head of the department was this white male, and he was getting upset about all of this, things that I was involved in, as far, you know, with the company and stuff like that. Like, but anyway, so he was firing me behind that. So I was thinking, like, you know what? I had to tell him. I said, you know what? I was thinking in my head, like, you know what? This whole black unity thing that I'm loyalty or whatever, like, that's about to get me fired. You know what I'm saying? That's whack. And so I just told him, I'm like, well, listen, don't even have to worry about me, you know, looking for me or anything. Like, I'll be under, you know, this other white guy. He wanted me to, you know, be working with him or whatever, you know. I said, you ain't got to worry about it. You know, I'll be with him and, you know, just give me, you know, just you keep an eye on me. I'll keep my word and you'll see what it is. He was like, all right. Man, I was working with the guy that he, you know, the white people he wanted me to work with. I wasn't doing, you know, I wasn't doing anything. I don't know. They used to run around that place and not do anything. And I was like, you know, this is not my style, but it's giving me my job. On top of that, you know, I'm not doing, you know. So it was, you know, I had to keep my eye on what it was that I needed. And, the black male, he understood what it was, you know. He didn't trip or whatever. So, you know, it. I don't know. I just.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I got a question for Gus.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes,
Hello?
Sir. We can hear you. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Oh, all right. I apologize for the background noise. I'm at the beach right now. But the question I have for Gus is, I frequently hear you say on the program, after you make a statement, that, you know, I could be wrong, I could be incorrect. Did you was that a suggestion you got from Dale Carnegie, or was that something you came up on your own? Might want to mute me right now, because the airplane passing by.
Oh, okay. Airplane passing by. I got that, and Be More touched on that earlier. I heard Mr. Fuller say that before I read Mr. Carnegie. I read Mr. Fuller's book first, and then I read Mr. Carnegie's book soon thereafter, because I was having conflict talking about racism, and so I read his book to try to get help, and he did have a lot of great suggestions. But I heard Mr. Fuller, he would always say, unless I've been misinformed. That was his phrase, unless I've been misinformed. And he said that he got that from Casablanca, where there's a scene where the character, I think he says, he got bad information, or something. He ends up in this wacky place, and the guy's asking him, he's like, I was misinformed. And so he said he just started saying that because he's a big fan of Casablanca, unless I've been misinformed. And I found that I started saying it because, number one, I found that non-white people, you don't really have any credence. It's like, you're a nigger. If you have a PhD, if you're the president, if you're Secretary of State, if you're a five-star general, if you have $1 million, if you have 21 Grammys, it doesn't matter. You're a nigger. You are a nigger. I mean, just all day, every day. PhD, doctorate, MD, MBA, whatever. So once I was honest about that, I started to tailor the way that I spoke for someone who has very little credibility. So I would just concede that I could be wrong. That way, it would take away from, who does this nigger think he is? Because it's like, oh, okay, the nigger's already acknowledging that, you know, he doesn't really know what the hell he's talking about, and he could be wrong, so okay, we can tolerate. That's really, you know, that's how my brain computer is processing it, and I feel like that is much more successful for me, and I would say generally for non-white people. I think that I've seen where it's been effective. Not even necessarily where they're going in and saying that I could be incorrect, but where that non-white people, I've seen where Dr. Welsen can do it, Mr. Fuller, non-white people, where they can remain calm, and they're not talking as though they are preaching down. If they're talking to a non-white person, they're not talking as though they're preaching down to them or trying to belittle them in discussing racism, white supremacy. I found that that's work, and I just put all that whole, I could be incorrect, I might be wrong, I put all of that under the rubric of, we're on the same level, I'm not going to just try and come out and jump on top of this person and tell them how dumb and ignorant they are, regardless of what they're doing. I do make mistakes, and I want to admit to that, and I am still learning, because that's, you know, one of the things we also keep saying. That's same rubric, all of that, throw that in the same pile, which also I got from Mr. Fuller, still learning. Just so that we get out of that thinking that I'm an expert, thinking that I'm something other than I am, which is a victim of racism, white supremacy. If that's what all this is going to come back to at some point in time, if we're going to further study racism, white supremacy, if all of this is going to get back to all of us, regardless of what our status is, niggers, then we should just try and start as close to that as possible. Not from, I'm holier than thou, I've been reading this, I know this information, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, you're sleeping with a white woman and eating a pork sandwich and, you know, all. I just haven't found that that's effective. So that's why I do it. I heard Mr. Fuller doing it, and then Dale Carnegie reaffirmed it. And many other things that Mr. Fuller's saying, which I thought was also pretty revealing. There were two other people that dialed in, 1804 and 1922. Your lines are both open.
This is 1804. I just wanted to say yes. I know of the Black Jackson, and I'll stop here.
This is 1922. The one that called earlier, I kind of, you know, lost connection. But thanks for answering my question. Appreciate it.
I have an observation. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I noticed in chapter 2 it says that a challenge arouses opposition and makes the listener want to battle with you. But further in the book, one of the principles is to throw down a challenge. So I'm wondering if it's contradicting itself here. But I know in when they're talking about the challenge in chapter 2, well, they were saying trying to make someone agree with your point of view using ridicule and abuse is not going to work. And then directly challenging the person is going to cause a direct opposition. But then, later on, Teddy Roosevelt, someone presented a challenge to him, like, are you going to give up? And then when you do that to someone, psychologically, it will bring something out of you to proceed on. So, but it's still a challenge. So, you know, I think it's a challenge either way. So I guess a challenge can be positive and negative. But I could be wrong.
I agree with that. I think you said it well enough, like you understand it. It sounds like you understand it. They can be, you know, this depends on the time, place, or whatever, you know. That's where your senses come in, to know when, you know, to challenge a person, you know, when that'll be good, challenge them, you know, do five more, or, you know, get it done, or whatever, encouragement and stuff like that, right, or... Some people, man, they can't, you know, some people will not do anything unless you challenge them. That's when they, I mean, you know what I'm saying, some people, but they, for some reason, my personality was like that when I was young. Like, I felt, people thought I was gifted or something, and, I mean, things came easy or whatever, but I didn't feel comfortable being, like, out in the front, you know, but if somebody would say something about like, you know, me not being able to do something, I would go off, you know. And I started noticing that, like,
Like, and I never was one of those people to say, dare me to do it. And see, you know, I was never one of them, but I've heard that before. But yeah, some people they're not really motivated unless they're challenged. And some people have that type of personality, so you just have to, like I said, use your senses and be able to, you know, put things together. You use your logic and put it together, and hopefully you'll be able to know the difference and not get them reversed.
Thank you for that.
I guess around challenges, we're going to hopefully get ready to start the second audio segment in a bit. Just around that, I have heard, I think this came up around Clarence Thomas over the past 10 days or so, individuals saying the importance of holding other black people, other victims of racism, accountable, quote unquote, whatever that means. And I have heard some of the most vile and discourteous attacks on other victims of racism done in the name of holding other victims of racism accountable, quote unquote, whatever that means. So I would just put out a word of caution on that. And I would encourage, if there's going to be any accounting to be done, I would say that we should all begin by holding ourselves accountable. First and foremost, if you can hold yourself accountable, that should keep you more than tied up with making sure everything has been done correctly. I think it's probably a very, very minute number of non-white people in the world who can say that they are doing everything correctly on their counter-racist checklist, even if such a person exists. So that would be my recommendation.
That reminds me of something. You know, when you go to the Black Talk radio page or whatever with the cows, the first comment you see is somebody saying hold Obama accountable. And I seen that for a while. I was like, man. But then if you scroll down, there are more recent comments, and I never knew that. All this time I've gone to that site or whatever, I didn't know that. I just thought nobody else wrote anything. But that's I guess the oldest is the one that you see, and then you scroll down, you get the more recent comments. If people were wondering why they see that same comment of accountability as far as Obama or whatever, if you scroll down, you'll see more recent comments or whatever. It just reminded me of that because I didn't know that for a long time. So if somebody didn't know that I just given that information. It's not like, I mean, if you scroll down to I think the latest comment was somebody saying that they're not listening to the cows no more. It's too depressing. I mean, I'm not saying really. It just reminded me of that. But, yeah, I agree with what you said, Gus. And I hear people talking about the accountability thing. And I don't know, I don't know exactly what they mean. Yeah, but you said it best, so I don't have to put nothing more on it.
I'd say it's probably fitting about the Obama comment being front and center there, because that likely will be a front and center aspect of racism, white supremacy for at least another 3.5 years. It certainly will be a hallmark aspect. Can you mute your line, or I can do it? A lot of background noise. A lot of background noise. Okay. Yeah, it will be a hallmark of the next year and the next 3.5 years, with the anti-blackness just being ferocious right now. So it might be fitting that it's there, kind of reminding us that this is what racist man, racist woman are doing. Page program that is supposed to be dedicated to racism, white supremacy, where it is stated explicitly the problem is white people. The focus still somehow is we need to hold another victim of racism accountable. That's what domination looks like. And I think the depression that has been that also is an anthem for racist man, racist woman. That's why a lot of people, they just, the avoidance, you know, the world that we live in is pretty depressing. I don't know, I guess you could say the cows is depressing, or you could turn on television and watch the George Zimmerman trial. You can take a pick, man. Take your pick, whichever way you want to go about it.
Another thing, yeah, I don't know if people are writing down, or I don't know if they're taking notes at all, but, you know, some of the people that they mentioned, you know, they had mentioned Abraham Lincoln, you know, he's the author, Sam, talking about Abraham Lincoln again, and General E. Lee, General Lee of the Confederacy and stuff like that. Write down some of the, because some of the information that he's given about these people is incorrect. So I'm just saying, like, you can get a, just write down the history. I mean, if you want, right? He's mentioning interesting people, very interesting people, and but just some of the things that he's saying about them is you know. So like, if you, I don't know, like everything is a good reference. Is like I find it interesting. Like when he talks about General, Lee, I mean, just. It's just that whole, you know, I think of General Lee, I make the association of that he was at the, he had marched to like, I don't remember because I haven't read it in a while, but I don't know how to say it, but he could have took the White House. You know, he could have took the White House, so. Why he did not do that, I don't exactly recall right now, but it's deep. Like the history that we've been given is just not correct. So I don't know. Like I just recommend write some of these names down and maybe do, you know, if you want, if you're interested in some of these names, man, do some research. You'll find some interesting things out.
How about the part? Say about yourself all the derogatory things you know the other person is thinking or want to say, and your mistakes may be minimized. Does anyone else see that as a constructive?
Absolutely.
Method?
Yes. I do it all the time, and it works. You, at the end of the day, people might not be interested in talking about racism, white supremacy, or whatever, but you say the wrong thing, and they'll remind you that you are a nigga. They don't say nothing about, but you get to, you know, you think you start thinking something or whatever, they become. They become real educated on your status. So, you know, yes, that works. At the end of the day, they're thinking that you're just a nigga. So, yeah, Gus kind of said it, but yeah, it does definitely work. I do it all the time. I did it before I even got some real. I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure I got it from my from my parents, grandparents, and stuff like that. Their knowledge kind of. Hit me to that, and the fact that, you know, yeah, but that's, I don't know if people do that naturally, but I suspect people that don't do that, they have a lot of conflict in their lives, man. They have a lot of conflict in their lives. I would say so. I mean, even though I don't know, but I would bet on that. People that haven't adopted that type of, black people, especially, that haven't adopted that type of, skill, they have a lot of conflict in their life, a lot of arguments, a lot of this, that, and the other, a lot of wasting the time.
How much more time do we have, Gus? Can I give another anecdote?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it kind of goes along with you saying about the timing of things. Almost to the month in June, I think it was June 2nd, 2010, a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers was about to pitch a perfect game. And the odds of pitching a perfect game is something like 1 in 20,000 or something. You got a better chance of getting struck by lightning. But this guy had a perfect game going, and he had 26 people out. The 27th person was up. The guy hit a weak hit towards first base. The first baseman got it. Pitcher ran to first base, threw the ball to him. He was obviously out. The game was over. He had a perfect game. But the umpire, Jim Joyce, made an incorrect call. It's gone down in history. The umpire that stole the perfect game for, I believe his name was, I'm going to screw it up, but his name was Galileo Vega. And someone could Google it. But Dale Carnegie's book on how to win friends and influence people in the digital age talks about it. And they turned that whole thing around because what happened, Jim Joyce quickly, after viewing the replay, he realized he made a bad call. He immediately went to the locker room after the game and apologized to the pitcher. So this guy accepted his apology, gave him a hug or whatever, and then he talked about how he took the high road, how noble he was for accepting the apology. And for some reason, it didn't rub me the right way. It's almost like, you know, he stole that guy's piece of history. The guy's not even known now, but he would have been one of 21 or 23 people to ever pitch a perfect game. And now he's the guy that had the game stolen from him.
Go ahead. Was he a non-white person, the pitcher?
Yes. If you go by his name, but from the way he looks Hispanic, you know, like white Hispanic. So, it just seems odd that, you know, the umpire who made the obvious wrong call, you know, and the pitcher forgave him, and somehow the umpire ends up more important than the pitcher who got the perfect game stolen from. It's just, I don't know, it didn't rub me the right way. I guess he was stressing the point that if you make a mistake, then you should admit it quickly, and then that makes everything all right. But I don't see how a guy loses a perfect game, how that could be all right for him right now. I don't know. I may be missing something.
It's the umpire. It made it right for the umpire. Like you said, he became the thing, and the pitcher, he's forgotten. It's just you know, we say game, but it's skill. It's refinement, man. It's what you do to keep your job. It's what you do to save face. It's what you do as a certain kind of skill, so people will look at you and say, "Wow, look, man, he apologized." You know, people like Benjamin Franklin and all that stuff. He didn't do that because he was a nice guy. He did that to get over. He did that to get what he wanted. He did that for power. This is what this book is about. This is power. This is ruler. This is power stuff right here. You know what I'm saying? This is for white people that want to be empowered. This is the game that they. This is the knowledge
and you know that they have. These are the skills and the tactics that they employ to look like angels. You know, they're the white cake angels. You know what I mean? That was the purpose of that umpire doing that. He had enough knowledge. Somebody might have told him, or he might have had it, or you know, never know what school he got that knowledge somewhere. I need to. You know, if I want to keep my job, or whatever he was thinking, he knew that he had to do it, and he had to do it quick. He had to make that decision, so he went in and so-called apologized. He probably didn't, you know, if he was a non-white person, or he thought he was a non-white person, or whatever. He might, man. That's the purpose of this whole thing. This is knowledge. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
On how to dominate, I suspect. Yeah, I agree. We were a little late getting started because there has been a problem with the clips getting it started, and as opposed to interrupting and just to say that the sound clip is not playing, I just allowed the dialogue to continue. But there's a problem getting it started, and I'm not able to get it corrected, so I'm just going to switch and play it from my iTunes. The sound quality might be a little bit off. I doubt it. The archive will be fine, but yeah, it's because the white people, I suspect, might be causing problems with the switchboard. But we'll go ahead and get started. If the people that are on the line, if you could mute your line, that would be helpful. We'll go ahead and get started with segment number 2 of Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Context of White Supremacy.
Michael Chong, who teaches our course in Hong Kong, told of how the Chinese culture presents some special problems, and how sometimes it is necessary to recognize that the benefits of applying a principle may be more advantageous than maintaining an old tradition. He had one middle-aged class member who had been estranged from his son for many years. The father had been an opium addict, but now was cured. In Chinese tradition, an older person cannot take the first step. The father felt that it was up to his son to take the initiative toward a reconciliation. In an early session, he told the class about the grandchildren he had never seen and how much he desired to be reunited with his son. His classmates, all Chinese, understood his conflict between his desire and long-established tradition. The father felt that young people should have respect for their elders and that he was right in not giving in to his desire, but to wait for his son to come to him. Toward the end of the course, the father again addressed the class. "I have pondered this problem," he said. "Dale Carnegie says if you are wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically. It is too late for me to admit it quickly, but I can admit it emphatically. I wronged my son. He was right in not wanting to see me and to expel me from his life. I may lose face by asking a younger person's forgiveness, but I was at fault, and it is my responsibility to admit this." The class applauded and gave him their full support. At the next class, he told how he went to his son's house, asked for and received forgiveness, and was now embarked on a new relationship with his son, his daughter-in-law, and the grandchildren he had met at last. Elbert Hubbard was one of the most original authors who ever stirred up a nation. His stinging sentences often aroused fierce resentment. But Hubbard, with his rare skill for handling people, frequently turned his enemies into friends. For example, when some irritated reader wrote in to say that he didn't agree with such and such an article, and ended by calling Hubbard this and that, Elbert Hubbard would answer like this: "Come to think it over, I don't entirely agree with it myself. Not everything I wrote yesterday appeals to me today. I am glad to learn what you think on the subject. The next time you're in the neighborhood, you must visit us, and we'll get this subject threshed out for all time. So here is a hand clasp over the miles, and I am yours sincerely." And what could you say to a man who treated you like that? When we're right, let's try to win people gently and tactfully to our way of thinking. And when we're wrong, and that will be surprisingly often if we're honest with ourselves, let's admit our mistakes quickly and with enthusiasm. Not only will that technique produce astonishing results, but believe it or not, it is a lot more fun under the circumstances than trying to defend oneself. Remember the old proverb, "By fighting you never get enough, but by yielding you get more than you expected. Principle 3. If you're wrong, admit it quickly and emphatically. Chapter 4. A Drop of Honey. If your temper is aroused and you tell them a thing or two, you'll have a fine time unloading your feelings. But what about the other person? Will he share your pleasure? Will your belligerent tones, your hostile attitude, make it easy for him to agree with you? If you come at me with your fists doubled, said Woodrow Wilson, I think I can promise you that mine will double as fast as yours. But if you come to me and say, let us sit down and take counsel together, and if we differ from each other, understand why it is that we differ, just what the points at issue are, we will presently find that we are not so far apart after all, that the points on which we differ are few, and the points on which we agree are many, and that if we only have the patience and the candor and the desire to get together, we will get together. Nobody appreciated the truth of Woodrow Wilson's statement more than John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Back in 1915, Rockefeller was the most fiercely despised man in Colorado. One of the bloodiest strikes in the history of American industry had been shocking the state for two terrible years. Irate, belligerent miners were demanding higher wages from the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company. Rockefeller controlled that company. Property had been destroyed. Troops had been called out. Blood had been shed. Strikers had been shot, their bodies riddled with bullets. At a time like that, with the air seething with hatred, Rockefeller wanted to win the strikers to his way of thinking. And he did it. How? Here's the story. After weeks spent in making friends, Rockefeller addressed the representatives of the strikers. This speech, in its entirety, is a masterpiece. It produced astonishing results. It calmed the tempestuous waves of hate that threatened to engulf Rockefeller. It won him a host of admirers. It presented facts in such a friendly manner that the strikers went back to work without saying another word about the increase in wages for which they had fought so violently. The opening of that remarkable speech follows. Note how it fairly glows with friendliness. Rockefeller, remember, was talking to men who, a few days previously, had wanted to hang him by the neck to a sour apple tree. Yet he couldn't have been more gracious, more friendly, if he had addressed a group of medical missionaries. His speech was radiant with such phrases as, I am proud to be here, having visited in your homes, met many of your wives and children. We meet here not as strangers, but as friends. Spirit of mutual friendship, our common interests, it is only by your courtesy that I am here. This is a red letter day in my life, Rockefeller began. It is the first time I have ever had the good fortune to meet the representatives of the employees of this great company, its officers and superintendents together, and I can assure you that I am proud to be here, and that I shall remember this gathering as long as I live. Had this meeting been held 2 weeks ago, I should have stood here a stranger to most of you, recognizing a few faces. Having had the opportunity last week of visiting all the camps in the southern coal field, and of talking individually with practically all of the representatives, except those who were away, having visited in your homes, met many of your wives and children, we meet here not as strangers, but as friends. And it is in that spirit of mutual friendship that I am glad to have this opportunity to discuss with you our common interests. Since this is a meeting of the officers of the company and the representatives of the employees, it is only by your courtesy that I am here, for I am not so fortunate as to be either one or the other. And yet I feel that I am intimately associated with you men, for in a sense I represent both the stockholders and the directors. Isn't that a superb example of the fine art of making friends out of enemies? Suppose Rockefeller had taken a different tack. Suppose he had argued with those miners and hurled devastating facts in their faces. Suppose he had told them by his tones and insinuations that they were wrong. Suppose that by all the rules of logic he had proved that they were wrong. What would have happened? More anger would have been stirred up, more hatred, more revolt. If a man's heart is rankling with discord and ill feeling toward you, you can't win him to your way of thinking with all the logic in Christendom. Scolding parents and domineering bosses and husbands and nagging wives ought to realize that people don't want to change their minds. They can't be forced or driven to agree with you or me, but they may possibly be led to, if we are gentle and friendly, ever so gentle and ever so friendly. Lincoln said that, in effect, over 100 years ago. Here are his words. It is an old and true maxim that a drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall. So with men, if you would win a man to your cause, first convince him that you are his sincere friend. Therein is a drop of honey that catches his heart, which, say what you will, is the great high road to his reason. Business executives have learned that it pays to be friendly to strikers. For example, when 2,500 employees in the White Motor Company's plant struck for higher wages and a union shop, Robert F. Black, then president of the company, didn't lose his temper and condemn and threaten and talk of tyranny and communists. He actually praised the strikers. He published an advertisement in the Cleveland papers, complimenting them on the peaceful way in which they laid down their tools. Finding the strike pickets idle, he bought them a couple of dozen baseball bats and gloves and invited them to play ball on vacant lots. For those who preferred bowling, he rented a bowling alley. This friendliness on Mr. Black's part did what friendliness always does. It begot friendliness. So the strikers borrowed brooms, shovels, and rubbish carts and began picking up matches, papers, cigarette stubs, and cigar butts around the factory. Imagine it. Imagine strikers tidying up the factory grounds while battling for higher wages and recognition of the union. Such an event had never been heard of before in the long, tempestuous history of American labor wars. That strike ended with a compromise settlement within a week, ended without any ill feeling or rancor. Daniel Webster, who looked like a god and talked like Jehovah, was one of the most successful advocates who ever pleaded a case. Yet he ushered in his most powerful arguments with such friendly remarks as, "It will be for the jury to consider. This may perhaps be worth thinking of. Here are some facts that I trust you will not lose sight of." Or, "You, with your knowledge of human nature, will easily see the significance of these facts." No bulldozing, no high-pressure methods, no attempt to force his opinions on others. Webster used the soft-spoken, quiet, friendly approach, and it helped to make him famous. You may never be called on to settle a strike or address a jury, but you may want to get your rent reduced. Will the friendly approach help you then? Let's see. O.L. Straub, an engineer, wanted to get his rent reduced, and he knew his landlord was hard-boiled. "I wrote him," Mr. Straub said in a speech before the class, "notifying him that I was vacating my apartment as soon as my lease expired. The truth was, I didn't want to move. I wanted to stay if I could get my rent reduced, but the situation seemed hopeless. Other tenants had tried and failed. Everyone told me that the landlord was extremely difficult to deal with. But I said to myself, I'm studying a course in how to deal with people, so I'll try it on him and see how it works. He and his secretary came to see me as soon as he got my letter. I met him at the door with a friendly greeting. I fairly bubbled with goodwill and enthusiasm. I didn't begin talking about how high the rent was. I began talking about how much I liked his apartment house. Believe me, I was hearty in my approbation and lavish in my praise. I complimented him on the way he ran the building, and I told him I should like so much to stay for another year, but I couldn't afford it. He evidently never had such a reception from a tenant. He hardly knew what to make of it. Then he started to tell me his troubles. Complaining tenants, one had written him 14 letters, some of them positively insulting. Another threatened to break his lease unless the landlord kept the man on the floor above from snoring. 'What a relief it is,' he said, 'to have a satisfied tenant like you.' And then, without my even asking him to do it, he offered to reduce my rent a little. I wanted more, so I named the figure I could afford to pay, and he accepted without a word." As he was leaving, he turned to me and asked, "What decorating can I do for you?" If I tried to get the rent reduced by the methods the other tenants were using, I am positive I would have met with the same failure they encountered. It was the friendly, sympathetic, appreciative approach that won. Dean Woodcock of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is the superintendent of a department of the local electric company. His staff was called upon to repair some equipment on top of a pole. This type of work had formerly been performed by a different department and had only recently been transferred to Woodcock's section. Although his people had been trained in the work, this was the first time they ever actually had been called upon to do it. Everybody in the organization was interested in seeing if and how they could handle it. Mr. Woodcock, several of his subordinate managers, and members of the other departments of the utility went to see the operation. Many cars and trucks were there, and a number of people were standing around watching the two lone men on top of the pole. Glancing around, Woodcock noticed a man up the street getting out of his car with a camera. He began taking pictures of the scene. Utility people are extremely conscious of public relations, and suddenly Woodcock realized what this setup looked like to the man with the camera. Overkill, dozens of people being called out to do a two-person job. He strolled up the street to the photographer. "I see you're interested in our operation." "Yes, and my mother will be more than interested. She owns stock in your company. This will be an eye-opener for her. She may even decide her investment was unwise. I've been telling her for years that there's a lot of waste motion in companies like yours. This proves it. The newspapers might like these pictures, too." "Well, it does look like it, doesn't it? I'd think the same thing in your position, but this is a unique situation." And Dean Woodcock went on to explain how this was the first job of this type for his department and how everybody, from executives down, was interested. He assured the man that under normal conditions, two people could handle the job. The photographer put away his camera, shook Woodcock's hand, and thanked him for taking the time to explain the situation to him. Dean Woodcock's friendly approach saved his company much embarrassment and bad publicity. Another member of one of our classes, Gerald H. Wynn of Littleton, New Hampshire, reported how, by using a friendly approach, he obtained a very satisfactory settlement on a damage claim. "Early in the spring," he reported, "before the ground had thawed from the winter freezing, there was an unusually heavy rainstorm, and the water, which normally would have run off to nearby ditches and storm drains along the road, took a new course onto a building lot where I just built a new home. Not being able to run off, the water pressure built up around the foundation of the house. The water forced itself under the concrete basement floor, causing it to explode, and the basement filled with water. This ruined the furnace and the hot water heater. The cost to repair this damage was in excess of $2,000. I had no insurance to cover this type of damage. However, I soon found out that the owner of the subdivision had neglected to put in a storm drain near the house, which could have prevented this problem. I made an appointment to see him. During the 25-mile trip to his office, I carefully reviewed the situation, and remembering the principles I learned in this course, I decided that showing my anger would not serve any worthwhile purpose. When I arrived, I kept very calm, and started by talking about his recent vacation to the West Indies. And then, when I felt the timing was right, I mentioned the little problem of water damage. He quickly agreed to do his share in helping to correct the problem. A few days later, he called and said he would pay for the damage and also put in a storm drain to prevent the same thing from happening in the future. Even though it was the fault of the owner of the subdivision, if I'd not begun in a friendly way, there would have been a great deal of difficulty in getting him to agree to the total liability. Years ago, when I was a barefoot boy walking through the woods to a country school out in northwest Missouri, I read a fable about the sun and the wind. They quarreled about which was the stronger, and the wind said, "I'll prove I am. See the old man down there with a coat? I can get that coat off him quicker than you can." So the sun went behind a cloud, and the wind blew until it was almost a tornado, but the harder it blew, the tighter the old man clutched his coat to him. Finally, the wind calmed down and gave up, and then the sun came out from behind the clouds and smiled kindly on the old man. Presently he mopped his brow and pulled off his coat. The sun then told the wind that gentleness and friendliness were always stronger than fury and force. The use of gentleness and friendliness is demonstrated day after day by people who have learned that a drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall. F. Gale Connor of Lutherville, Maryland, proved this when he had to take his 4-month-old car to the service department of the car dealer for the third time. He told our class, "It was apparent that talking to, reasoning with, or shouting at the service manager was not going to lead to a satisfactory resolution of my problems. I walked over to the showroom and asked to see the agency owner, Mr. White. After a short wait, I was ushered into Mr. White's office. I introduced myself and explained to him that I had bought my car from his dealership because of the recommendation of friends who had had previous dealings with him. I was told that his prices were very competitive and that his service was outstanding. He smiled with satisfaction as he listened to me. Then I explained the problem that I was having with the service department. I thought you might want to be aware of any situation that might tarnish your fine reputation, I added. He thanked me for calling this to his attention and assured me that my problem would be taken care of. Not only did he personally get involved, but he also lent me his car to use while mine was being repaired. Aesop was a Greek slave who lived at the court of Croesus and spun immortal fables 600 years before Christ. Yet the truths he taught about human nature are just as true in Boston and Birmingham now as they were 26 centuries ago in Athens. The sun can make you take off your coat more quickly than the wind, and kindliness, the friendly approach, and appreciation can make people change their minds more readily than all the bluster and storming in the world. Remember what Lincoln said, "A drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall." Principle 4. Begin in a friendly way. Chapter 5. The Secret of Socrates. In talking with people, don't begin by discussing the things on which you differ. Begin by emphasizing and keep on emphasizing the things on which you agree. Keep emphasizing, if possible, that you are both striving for the same end, and that your only difference is one of method and not of purpose. Get the other person saying yes, yes at the outset. Keep your opponent, if possible, from saying no. A no response, according to Professor Overstreet, is a most difficult handicap to overcome. When you have said no, all your pride of personality demands that you remain consistent with yourself. You may later feel that the no was ill-advised. Nevertheless, there is your precious pride to consider. Once having said a thing, you feel you must stick to it. Hence, it is of the very greatest importance that a person be started in the affirmative direction. The skillful speaker gets at the outset a number of yes responses. This sets the psychological process of the listeners moving in the affirmative direction. It's like the movement of a billiard ball. Propel in one direction, and it takes some force to deflect it, far more force to send it back in the opposite direction. The psychological patterns here are quite clear. When a person says no and really means it, he or she is doing far more than saying a word of two letters. The entire organism, glandular, nervous, muscular, gathers itself together into a condition of rejection. There is, usually in minutes, but sometimes in observable degree, a physical withdrawal or readiness for withdrawal. The whole neuromuscular system, in short, sets itself on guard against acceptance. When, to the contrary, a person says yes, none of the withdrawal activities takes place. The organism is in a forward-moving, accepting, open attitude. Hence, the more yeses we can at the very outset induce, the more likely we are to succeed in capturing the attention for our ultimate proposal. It is a very simple technique, this yes response, and yet how much it is neglected. It often seems as if people get a sense of their own importance by antagonizing others at the outset. get a student to say no at the beginning, or a customer, child, husband, or wife, and it takes the wisdom and the patience of angels to transform that bristling negative into an affirmative. The use of this yes, yes technique enabled James Eberson, who was a teller at the Greenwich Savings Bank in New York City, to secure a prospective customer who might otherwise have been lost. "This man came in to open an account," said Mr. Eberson, "and I gave him our usual form to fill out. Some of the questions he answered willingly, but there were others he flatly refused to answer. Before I began the study of human relations, I would have told this prospective depositor that if he refused to give the bank this information, we should have to refuse to accept this account. I'm ashamed that I've been guilty of doing that very thing in the past. Naturally, an ultimatum like that made me feel good. I had shown who was boss, that the bank's rules and regulations couldn't be flouted. But that sort of attitude certainly didn't give a feeling of welcome and importance to the man who'd walked in to give us his patronage. I resolved this morning to use a little horse sense. I resolved not to talk about what the bank wanted, but about what the customer wanted. And above all else, I was determined to get him saying yes, yes from the very start. So I agreed with him. I told him the information he refused to give was not absolutely necessary. However, I said, suppose you have money in this bank at your death. Wouldn't you like to have the bank transfer it to your next of kin, who's entitled to it according to law? Yes, of course, he replied. Don't you think, I continued, that it would be a good idea to give us the name of your next of kin, so that in the event of your death, we could carry out your wishes without error or delay? Again, he said yes. The young man's attitude softened and changed when he realized that we weren't asking for this information for our sake, but for his sake. Before leaving the bank, this young man not only gave me complete information about himself, but he opened, at my suggestion, a trust account, naming his mother as the beneficiary for his account, and he gladly answered all the questions concerning his mother also. I found that by getting him to say yes, yes from the outset, he forgot the issue at stake and was happy to do all the things that I suggested. Joseph Allison, a sales representative for Westinghouse Electric Company, had this story to tell. There was a man in my territory that our company was most eager to sell to. My predecessor had called on him for 10 years without selling anything. When I took over the territory, I called steadily for 3 years without getting an order. Finally, after 13 years of calls and sales talk, we sold him a few motors. If these proved to be all right, an order for several hundred more would follow. Such was my expectation. Right? I knew they'd be all right. So when I called 3 weeks later, I was in high spirits. The chief engineer greeted me with this shocking announcement. "Allison, I can't buy the remainder of the motors from you." "Why?" I asked in amazement. "Why?" "Because your motors are too hot. I can't put my hand on them." I knew it wouldn't do any good to argue. I'd tried that sort of thing too long. So I thought of getting the yes, yes response. "Well, now look, Mr. Smith," I said. "I agree with you 100%. If those motors are running too hot, you ought not to buy any more of them. You must have motors that won't run any hotter than standards set by the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. Isn't that so?" He agreed it was. I'd gotten my first yes. The Electrical Manufacturers Association regulations say that a properly designed motor may have a temperature of 72 degrees Fahrenheit above room temperature. Is that correct? Yes, he agreed. That's quite correct. But your motors are much hotter. I didn't argue with him. I merely asked, "How hot is the mill room?" "Oh," he said, "about 75 degrees Fahrenheit." "Well," I replied, "if the mill room is 75 degrees, and you add 72 to that, that makes a total of 147 degrees Fahrenheit. Wouldn't you scald your hand if you held it under a spigot of hot water at a temperature of 147 degrees Fahrenheit?" And again, he had to say yes. "Well," I suggested, "wouldn't it be a good idea to keep your hands off those motors?" "Oh, well, I guess you're right," he admitted. We continued to chat for a while. Then he called his secretary and lined up approximately $35,000 worth of business for the ensuing month. It took me years and cost me countless thousands of dollars in lost business before I finally learned that it doesn't pay to argue, that it is much more profitable and much more interesting to look at things from the other person's viewpoint and to try to get that person saying yes, yes. Eddie Snow, who sponsors our courses in Oakland, California, tells how he became a good customer of a shop because the proprietor got him to say, yes, yes. Eddie had become interested in bow hunting and had spent considerable money in purchasing equipment and supplies from a local bow store. When his brother was visiting him, he wanted to rent a bow for him from this store. The sales clerk told him they didn't rent bows, so Eddie phoned another bow store. Eddie described what happened. A very pleasant gentleman answered the phone. His response to my question for a rental was completely different from the other place. He said he was sorry, but they no longer rented bows because they couldn't afford to do so. He asked me if I'd rented before, and I replied yes several years ago. He reminded me that I probably paid $25 to $30 for the rental. I said yes again. Then he asked if I was the kind of person who liked to save money. Naturally, I answered yes. He went on to explain that they had bow sets with all the necessary equipment on sale for $34.95. I could buy a complete set for only $4.95 more than I could rent one. He explained that is why they had discontinued renting them. Did I think that was reasonable? My yes response led to a purchase of the set, and when I picked it up, I purchased several more items at this shop and have since become a regular customer. Socrates, the gadfly of Athens, was one of the greatest philosophers the world has ever known. He did something that only a handful of men in all history have been able to do. He sharply changed the whole course of human thought. And now, 24 centuries after his death, he is honored as one of the wisest persuaders who ever influenced this wrangling world. His method? Did he tell people they were wrong? Oh, no, not Socrates. He was far too adroit for that. His whole technique, now called the Socratic method, was based upon getting a yes, yes response. He asked questions with which his opponent would have to agree. He kept on winning one admission after another until he had an armful of yeses. He kept on asking questions until finally, without realizing it, his opponents found themselves embracing a conclusion they would have bitterly denied a few minutes previously. The next time we're tempted to tell someone he or she is wrong, let's remember old Socrates and ask a gentle question, a question that will get the yes, yes response. The Chinese have a proverb pregnant with the age-old wisdom of the Orient. He who treads softly goes far. They have spent 5,000 years studying human nature, those cultured Chinese, and they have garnered a lot of perspicacity. He who treads softly goes far. Principle 5. Get the other person saying yes, yes, immediately. Chapter 6. The safety valve in handling complaints. Most people trying to win others to their way of thinking do too much talking themselves. Let the other people talk themselves out. They know more about their business and problems than you do, so ask them questions. Let them tell you a few things. If you disagree with them, you may be tempted to interrupt, but don't. It's dangerous. They won't pay attention to you while they still have a lot of ideas of their own, crying for expression, so listen patiently and with an open mind. Be sincere about it. Encourage them to express their ideas fully. Does this policy pay in business? Let's see. Here is the story of a sales representative who was forced to try it. One of the largest automobile manufacturers in the United States was negotiating for a year's requirements of upholstery fabrics. Three important manufacturers had worked up fabrics in sample bodies. These had all been inspected by the executives of the motor company, and notice had been sent to each manufacturer saying that on a certain day, a representative from each supplier would be given an opportunity to make a final plea for the contract. GBR, a representative of one manufacturer, arrived in town with a severe attack of laryngitis. When it came my turn to meet the executives in conference, Mr. R. said, as he related the story before one of my classes, I had lost my voice. I could barely whisper. I was ushered into a room and found myself face to face with the textile engineer, the purchasing agent, the director of sales, and the president of the company. I stood up and made a valiant effort to speak, but I couldn't do anything more than squeak. They were all seated around a table, so I wrote on a pad of paper, "Gentlemen, I have lost my voice. I am speechless." "I'll do the talking for you," the president said. He did. He exhibited my samples and praised their good points. A lively discussion arose about the merits of my goods, and the president, since he was talking for me, took the position I would have had during the discussion. My sole participation consisted of smiles, nods, and a few gestures. As a result of this unique conference, I was awarded the contract, which called for over 500,000 yards of upholstery fabrics at an aggregate value of $1,600,000, the biggest order I had ever received. I know I would have lost the contract if I hadn't lost my voice, because I had the wrong idea about the whole proposition. I discovered, quite by accident, how richly it sometimes pays to let the other person do the talking. Letting the other person do the talking helps in family situations as well as in business. Barbara Wilson's relationship with her daughter, Lori, was deteriorating rapidly. Lori, who had been a quiet, complacent child, had grown into an uncooperative, sometimes belligerent teenager. Mrs. Wilson lectured her, threatened her, and punished her, but all to no avail. One day, Mrs. Wilson told one of our classes, I just gave up. Lori had disobeyed me and had left the house to visit her girlfriend before she had completed her chores. When she returned, I was about to scream at her for the 10,000th time, but I just didn't have the strength to do it. I just looked at her and said sadly, Why, Lori, why? Lori noted my condition and in a calm voice asked, Do you really want to know? I nodded, and Lori told me, first hesitantly, and then it all flowed out. I had never listened to her. I was always telling her to do this or that. When she wanted to tell me her thoughts, feelings, ideas, I interrupted with more orders. I began to realize that she needed me not as a bossy mother, but as a confidant, an outlet for all her confusion about growing up, and all I'd been doing was talking when I should have been listening. I had never heard her. From that time on, I let her do all the talking she wanted. She tells me what is on her mind, and our relationship has improved immeasurably. She is, again, a cooperative person. A large advertisement appeared on the financial page of a New York newspaper, calling for a person with unusual ability and experience. Charles T. Kubelis answered the advertisement, sending his reply to a box number. A few days later, he was invited by letter to call for an interview. Before he called, he spent hours in Wall Street finding out everything possible about the person who had founded the business. During the interview, he remarked, I should be mighty proud to be associated with an organization with a record like yours. I understand you started 28 years ago with nothing but desk room and one stenographer. Is that true? Almost every successful person likes to reminisce about his early struggles, and this man was no exception. He talked for a long time about how he'd started with $450 in cash and an original idea. He told how he'd fought against discouragement and battled against ridicule, working Sundays and holidays 12 to 16 hours a day, how he finally won against all odds, until now the most important executives on Wall Street were coming to him for information and guidance. He was proud of such a record. He had a right to be, and he had a splendid time telling about it. Finally, he questioned Mr. Kubelis briefly about his experience, then called in one of his vice presidents and said, I think this is the person we're looking for. Mr. Kubelis had taken the trouble to find out about the accomplishments of his prospective employer. He showed an interest in the other person and his problems. He encouraged the other person to do most of the talking and made a favorable impression. Roy G. Bradley of Sacramento, California, had the opposite problem. He listened as a good prospect for a sales position talked himself into a job with Bradley's firm. Roy reported, "Being a small brokerage firm, we had no fringe benefits, such as hospitalization, medical insurance, and pension. Every representative is an independent agent. We don't even provide leads for prospects, as we cannot advertise for them as our larger competitors do. Richard Pryor had the type of experience we wanted for this position, and he was interviewed first by my assistant, who told him about all the negatives related to this job. He seemed slightly discouraged when he came into my office. I mentioned the one benefit of being associated with my firm, that of being an independent contractor, and therefore virtually being self-employed. As he talked about these advantages to me, he talked himself out of each negative thought he had when he came in for the interview. Several times it seemed as though he was half-talking to himself, as he was thinking through each thought. At times I was tempted to add to his thoughts. However, as the interview came to a close, I felt he had convinced himself, very much on his own, that he would like to work for my firm. Because I had been a good listener and let Dick do most of the talking, he was able to weigh both sides fairly in his mind. And he came to the positive conclusion, which was a challenge he created for himself. We hired him, and he has been an outstanding representative for our firm." Even our friends would much rather talk to us about their achievements than listen to us boast about ours. La Rochefoucauld, the French philosopher, said, "If you want enemies, excel your friends. But if you want friends, let your friends excel you." Why is that true? Because when our friends excel us, they feel important. But when we excel them, they, or at least some of them, will feel inferior and envious. By far the best-liked placement counselor in the Midtown Personnel Agency in New York City was Henrietta G. It hadn't always been that way. During the first few months of her association with the agency, Henrietta didn't have a single friend among her colleagues. Why? Because every day she would brag about the placement she had made, the new account she had opened, and anything else she had accomplished. "I was good at my work and proud of it," Henrietta told one of our classes. "But instead of my colleagues sharing my triumphs, they seemed to resent them. I wanted to be liked by these people. I really wanted them to be my friends. After listening to some of the suggestions made in this course, I started to talk about myself less and listen more to my associates. They also had things to boast about and were more excited about telling me about their accomplishments than about listening to my boasting. Now, when we have some time to chat, I ask them to share their joys with me, and I only mention my achievements when they ask." Principle 6. Let the other person do a great deal of the talking.
Context of white supremacy. We should have about 20 minutes left. We started a little late getting the second segment going because the audio clip was just not playing from the broadcaster for some reason. Could be white interference. At any rate, I hope constructive information. The folks that are on the line, I think that's B-More, 909, Demery 4, your lines should all be open. If you did not get to participate in the first portion of the discussion, you should dial in now. We have a little less than 20 minutes, which should, you know, it's not a lot of time, but dial in. Definitely don't waste any time. The number is 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I hope the audio was tolerable. The podcast should be pristine. I will mute my line. Demery 4, 909, be more. You should be open.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
at the first part, when Roosevelt went to talk to the striking workers, they wanted higher wages, and I guess they wasn't getting recognized. You know,
what's important about that is the workers, after he got through with his speech, the workers didn't get anything. They went back to work without getting anything that they were originally protesting for. And it was the same thing in the other situation. You know, they all started playing baseball or bowling. You know, that was a diversionary tactic. I mean, it seems like those people would have stuck to their guns. And most of these techniques and principles remind me of sales techniques. Zig Ziglar, some of his techniques, getting people to say yes first. And, you know, I guess the closing is the big part of it. You have to watch out for that type of stuff. That's all deceptive. And if you're doing some negotiating, if it's genuine negotiating, then you hear one side, and the other side presents his views, and then you come to some type of agreement, you know, in the middle. But in this case, you know, it seems like the workers came up short. I want to say something about, well, everybody remember when there was the deep water horizon, the explosion of an oil rig in the ocean here, and the BP chief executive, Tony Hayward, was brought before a Senate investigative committee. And he gave an arrogant reaction. You know, there were 11 lives lost. And his reaction of dodging questions and ditching the blame turned on him, because, well, they asked him a group of questions, and I think they let him go. Then they found him later on on the southern coast of England, entered in a yacht race, you know, where basically he avoided the questions and did not admit to any wrongdoing. It ended up backfiring on him because he went from suspect to reject in the court of public opinion. And I think BP ended up letting him go. We were still stuck with a mess. They had to end up paying millions to help clean up. But it just goes to show that, you know, there's a way to handle these situations, and they think that they have all the answers, but, you know, an honest response and a genuine desire to reach an equitable conclusion would have sufficed. And we see a lot of this, and it's a lot of talk, but during today's times, we see very little of this type of thing going up. It usually ends up one way. And I don't have any examples where there was an equitable conclusion to anything. I have no antidotes to that. but I'll mute my line.
Nine, be more. Did you all have anything?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I thought I heard a female voice. I was thinking of A Drop of Honey. I think I mentioned this on the Cows before, but when I guess the so-called Jewish kids are coming up and, you know, they're learning the Torah, the parents give them, like, if they read they read a chapter, a couple chapters, verses or whatever, they give them a spoon of honey to so they associate the Torah with something sweet. And I don't know. I just never forgot that. I just thought about that one. That for that drop of honey thing. I tried to use that because, you know, like, some of my nephew, you know, I don't know. I'm just, some of my nephew. What am I talking about? In particular, my nephew. He was doing his homework, and he wasn't doing his homework, but he was doing some work. Some writing practices, but he was crying, and I remember being over there, and I was like, you know, no, this is not right. You know, he got to stop right now. I was like, that's okay, cool. You know, I'm basically telling him to calm down, but, you know, and my sister was like, well, he doesn't do it. I was like, yeah, but he's crying, and this is not. He's not in the state of mind, you know, to be doing this work. Like, he can get back to it, but he needs, you know, to calm down first, you know what I'm saying? Because he's going to associate this type of practice with, you know, straight negativity or whatever, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, luckily, you know, my sister, she didn't argue too much. Like, she just let me, you know, get him all straightened up and everything like that, and talk to. So, what else? Oh, I remember reading this book, Dune. It's called Dune. And they fight there in the book. They will fight. It's like a future science fiction or whatever. They will fight with the force fields. And you know, this one part, he's teaching the prince how to fight. They fight with knives, but each person has a force field. And he was saying, you know, they're sparring or whatever. But if you try to stab them with this knife, it won't go through the force field. Like, you know what I mean? He said it's the slow blade that, you know, that gets through the force field or whatever. You have to go through the force field slowly. Like, you can't put no force into it, and then you can get past the force field into the person's body. And I remember reading that and just realizing, like, how important it is to take things slow. Everything is just, Mr. Fuller said it, but I just remember, like, even back then, I was just like, man, that's what the yoga and lifting and everything, you know, and just taking time to read and everything, when you do it slow, but in this particular case, he was talking, you know, so I just think that's an awesome principle or whatever. It works. I use it all the time with people, you know, especially with people just taking it slow, really listening and stuff like that. Like, that's very important if you want to be successful. I guess I agree with, you know, with that part.
Jay-Z did mention the BP oil spill in the song that was played at the beginning of the program. since that was brought back up again. And the mute button, I use my mute button all the time. That anecdote about the white male racist suspect getting the big sale when he had laryngitis and didn't do a lot of talking. I think in racism, white supremacy, words are very important. And I also think that frequently a lot of non-white people feel that they're not being heard. And compiling on top of that, the fact that a lot of times we're forced to not talk about racism or avoid it, pretend it's not a problem sometimes. Non-white people really want to talk about racism and to be heard. So I think sometimes it's important to keep that in mind as well, to make sure that you don't just talk to try to win someone over. The importance of letting them speak, even if they're confused, you know, even if they're saying things that don't make a lot of sense. Like, I think it's important to give them an opportunity to express themselves. I think if you are doing that, they should be extending you that same courtesy to listen patiently and respectfully to what you have to say. I'll mute my line. We have about 7 minutes left.
I don't really have anything to say. Been taking a lot of notes, but nothing to touch on right now.
I always like to write down, like, names and stuff like this, just in case. He was talking about Woodrow Wilson and John D. Rockefeller, so I wrote that down, too. Yeah, I don't know if people read writings of, or you know, Socrates and all that, but I was a big fan of Socrates. I ain't gonna lie, when I was younger, I thought he had it down pat. When I read some of that stuff that he put down, I was like, oh man, this is it. This is the secret to win any argument, anywhere, anytime. And man, I would employ it on like adult, like people that, like on adults and stuff. Like people would try to tell me stuff and stuff. And I would use this what I learned from Socrates. That they would be like. They would be like, oh man, sometimes they would say, I'll have to come back and get with you later, and I'll answer your questions later. I'll see you next time, and this and that. Like, man. But later on I learned, I was like, oh, this is nothing but, this is some rhetoric right here. You know, it's just like a trick, you know. So I stopped being the debater or whatever. But man, yeah, that was interesting. Another part is interesting. He was talking about the no. He was saying how the neuromuscular system freezes up when they're not just, you know, somebody says no, like they shut. That's not just a word. Like they hold neuromuscular system shuts down. I think the evidence is, would say so. We were talking about that too, I think, one time.
I was thinking when that part was read, those same neuromuscular reactions to rejection, that those probably respond the same way towards dark people for white people. And I was thinking that I think even studies like white people having an averse reaction to the picture of a black person, I was even thinking that might all automatically be present to some degree, just if it's a black person, especially if you're talking about racism. So, you know, just keeping that in mind. I'll mute my line.
You know, I have to say something about FDR and also Teddy Roosevelt. You know, they keep referring to these guys, and one would believe that they were saints or that they had some type of magical powers or whatever. But on a recent NPR report, that was an author, Jonathan Alter, was discussing his book, The Defining Moment. It was on FDR, and FDR contracted polio at 39, but he had a personal valet, which was an African-American guy. His name was Irving McGuffey. And his name, you know, for all practical purposes, you know, was never known. And if FDR depended on this guy, he helped him, he had to put an iron leg brace on before he put his trousers on. And McDuffie had to lift him into his wheelchair and basically just push him around. He was like his right-hand man, probably the closest human being to him other than maybe his spouse. And that's a different story. But FDR never mentioned the guy, never gave him any credit. You know, to me, that goes a long way in showing his racist attitudes. And I think about when A. Philip Randolph went to talk to FDR about the conditions of the porters in his union. And he had gotten an audience with FDR because of Eleanor Roosevelt. And after dinner, when he had an audience with him, he told him all his concerns. And FDR said, "Well, I agree with everything you're saying. Now just go out there and make me do it." He didn't plan to do anything. And if we remember, during the 30s, that was a time when lynching was big in America. And I noticed some reference talking about the union people wanted to hang FDR from a sour apple tree. You know, all this references to hanging, you know, when this book was written, lynching was a very serious issue with black people. To no avail, brought up constantly before FDR. And Teddy Roosevelt talking about the Battle of San Juan. Buffalo soldiers saved his tail in the Battle of San Juan. And when he got back to the United States, he said that they were all cowards. You know, there was an incident in Brownsville, Texas, you know, where some white people were killed. And they blamed it on black soldiers. And Teddy Roosevelt, they couldn't get to the bottom of it. So he dishonorably discharged all of those soldiers. And it was like, I don't know, one left or something. He was 100 years old before they finally pardoned those guys. You know, so these Roosevelt fellas were blatant racists. And, you know, I just have a hard time finding any redeemable value from either one of them. I'll mute my line.
I know we overtime, Gus, but can I just make one point? Because I think it's important.
Quickly.
Quick. Okay, you reminded me when you said that white people have an adverse, you know, they have a neuromuscular reaction when they see us. I think that all the time, but it's just like when you said it, it just like reminded me of how important it needs to be said. So, yeah, that's how I think, but like it does bear repeating as many times as possible. People, they forget that. So I just wanted to say that. Another thing, this is important for people that have children. When my parents, when I was coming up, my parents, grandparents, they would make us, they didn't make us, but they would give us rewards for who would be silent, who could, you know, be silent the longest. You have to tell your children because that's the key to listen.
these principals, another thing, when they want something done, they want to get something big done. They want a scholarship, or they need money for something, or they want to get a job at a prestigious place. They, you know, just going in there, and not having done the research to get that position, that's not good. Like, if you have children, they can do some things. They can get into these organs, but they have to do the research to find out about the people that might be doing an interview, the people that own the business or whatever. So when they go in there, they can start asking questions. Oh, interesting things about how the position, how they got there, stuff like that. Like, this is invaluable. Like, this stuff, I don't know if parents are teaching their children this stuff, but like, if you're not, you're setting them up for a big disappointment, and they're going to be stray dependents their lives. I mean, this is invaluable stuff. So I just wanted to make that point, because I think that is very important.
Agreed. Demery for the Jonathan Alter, Alter, Jonathan Alter. He did the biography on FDR. The victim, Irvin McDuffie. You said he did an NPR interview where he was talking about Mr. McDuffie and how he had to assist FDR. Would it be asking too much to get that posted on my Facebook page? I would like to check that out. Maybe some other listeners would like to check that out as well. Was this a recent NPR interview, or? Uh-oh, maybe we lost him. See, did we lose him? Oh, we should be there. Can you hear me or no?
Oh, I had it muted.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yes, I can dig it back up, but I've been having problems. I've been trying to post some things on Facebook. I'm having problems with that. But I can email it to Until Justice.
Oh, that'll work. That'll work fine. I'll put it on my Facebook page. Once I get it, I'll share with the rest of folks, because I'd like to check that out too.
All right.
Cool. We'll be back tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific. Should be lots to discuss. We'll be looking forward to it. You all can check out that Jay-Z video. His new album is coming out Tuesday. The song is Oceans, featuring Frank Ocean. I think he's talking about race. I mean, explicitly, I feel like it's undeniable. The only Christopher we recognize is Wallace. I mean, I don't know what else you can be talking about. I mean, if I could be wrong. I could be wrong. So I will throw that out there. But I think he's talking about racism, white supremacy. You can check out the video. It's on my YouTube page. And if I suspect, as more people will hear this, because I suspect more people will hear it by Tuesday, so as more people hear it, I suspect you'll hear some people talking about this and, you know, saying, hey, is he talking about racism? What is he saying about racism? So you can be on the lookout, and that might be another easy one, way to talk about racism. I'm sure a lot of 35 and under, maybe even older folks, will be excited and chatting about the brand new Jay-Z album. So there's an easy one. Way to talk about racism with maybe some younger non-white people. Resist the urge to criticize. Avoid arguments. Use some of the techniques if you think they'll help out. Just make sure you watch out for the anti-blackness. I'm telling you, it can creep up in 30 seconds. It can go from everything is cool to B's and N's and oh my, sparks are flying. And nobody, you know, even knows how it got out of whack. Just be on alert. Keep it constructive. Thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope the broadcast was of some value. The creator, it has been time. Please do not forget the ancestors, those who were abused, terrorized, and made an effort to combat racism, white supremacy. They are not forgotten. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Cows signing up.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Yeah. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.